Members, we're going to start and call the committee, Minnesota House Committee on Public Safety and Criminal Justice Reform to order. And I'm wondering, Representative Howard, if you can make a motion to adopt the minutes of February 19th.
So moved.
Representative Howard moves adoption of the February 19th minutes. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Howard. Members, I'm sorry to start a few minutes late. We had a little bit of a snafu of getting an amendment. So what I'm going to do is go out of the order that we've got printed. I'm going to ask Representative New to come forward with House File 1263. Your lucky day, Representative. You get to go first.
Hey,
welcome.
This is my lucky day.
And hopefully this will be the quickest bill you hear today.
Representative New, the proper motion for you would be to lay House File, lay House File 1263 over for possible inclusion in the omnibus or omnibus bill. Is there a committee member that can move that?
So moved.
Representative Nash so moves, and so Representative New, your bill is before us.
Perfect. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. So you should have in front of you an article from last year. The impetus from this bill last year was that there was a little boy in my district who was killed by a man who had been snowmobiling drunk. The man had been convicted of multiple DWIs. He had an ignition interlock in his car. He had lost his license previously. And yet, so the fix that we did is that if you received a DWI on an ATV or snowmobile or motorboat, you could also lose your driving privileges. You would have the consequences associated as though the DWI had been received in your motor vehicle. We removed a first-time exemption to that. That was one thing that we did. However, that law did not go the other way. So what we did is we made sure that when you get a DWI in your car, that that also affects your privileges to drive ATVs, snowmobiles, and motorboats. So last year when we did that bill, there were a couple of omissions that we want to fix now. What this bill will do is the bill omitted failure of a sobriety test while operating the snowmobile, ATV, or motorboat as grounds for these consequences. So we want to add failure of the sobriety test. It had refusal, but not failure. We want to make sure that that's fixed. Also, in addition, the law is missing governing boating while intoxicated. It omitted the refusal of the sobriety test. So we want to make sure that that's included as well. And in fact, that's going to require the A1 amendment. So I guess I would ask if there's a member of the committee who would be willing to move that A1 amendment for me.
I'll move the
A1. Nash moves the A1 amendment. Give me a second while I look for it, quite frankly.
Mr. Chair, I don't have the A1.
I guess I won't move it then.
No, I don't think so.
Maybe if the pages could pass out the A1.
Why don't we continue with the conversation and we'll figure out what happened to your A1 amendment. We're going to lay this bill over so we can always act subsequently if it comes to that. We just want to make sure that we've got timely notice of the A1 amendment.
Sure, thank you.
But why don't you continue? And do you have testifiers as well on this bill?
Yes, actually. Colonel Smith is here from the DNR.
Why don't we do that, and great, that'll buy us a little bit of time to figure out the
thank you
technical aspect of your amendment.
I've got two testifiers on the bill, Colonel Smith and then Christian Franzen with MinUSA, the Snowmobile Association, is here also.
Welcome to our committee, and whoever wishes to start, please give us your name for the record and proceed with your testimony.
For the record, Colonel Rodman Smith, Director of Law Enforcement, Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Chair, members, we'd like to thank Representative New for continuing to help us merged the DWI or impaired driving statutes for recreational motor boats and traditional motor vehicles. As Representative New stated, we did this, or the legislature did this last year and it was passed into law. And DWI law is somewhat technical and there's a lot of moving parts to it. And this was something that was overlooked last year. And all this does is, Representative News, House File 1263 and the amendment that will be shared hopefully shortly just brings these more further into conformity between the two. And we support it.
Very well, thank you. And I'm told by our staff that the A1 amendment is appropriate in terms of having met that deadline and having been posted. I think the only issue is we don't have copies of it in front of us, but it has been publicly posted. And as soon as we have the copies here, then I'll turn to you, Representative Nash, to move that.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Christian Franson, and I'm here today on behalf of the Minnesota United Snowmobilers Association. As a statewide organization, we fully support the safe use of recreational vehicles. For that reason, bills such as this, which help to align DWI laws, we see as healthy for the state and overall safety of our sport. So for that, we'd like to thank the DNR and the author of the bill for putting forth such a good product. Thank you.
Terrific. Are there any questions for our testifiers? Perhaps let me just ask this. I think this bill makes a lot of sense, and I think our amendment does as well. The begging question is, what happened when we passed this bill that we didn't include this? Is it just...
That's a great question. Thank you, Mr. Chair. And members, honestly, it was an oversight. It was a relatively technical bill, and this literally was just an oversight.
Very well. I'm making sure the amendment gets passed out before we take the next step. Representative O'Neill and then Representative Johnson. Representative O'Neill, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was going to ask something kind of along those lines of, you know, how did this come to light that this was missed? And was there a case that happened where you weren't able to move forward with charges or something because of the way the statute was now written? You know, how did this come to light that this was an ongoing issue?
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, after the bill was passed, DNR, Department of Public Safety, Department of Driver Vehicle Services, Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, we all got together to figure out what this all looks like and how we could possibly get the recreational vehicle portion of DWIs into e-charging. And when all those great minds got together, we saw that there were a couple small things that we missed. And because, you know, DWI law is somewhat technical, these are some of the more technical points that were missed. And so as a group, we saw these issues and then we brought them back and wanted to make changes this year. So there was no case, but it was just the people getting together after the fact and sorting out what happened and how to move forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's good to know that there wasn't a case that, you know, wasn't able to move forward with charges or something because of the lack, but it's great to see that all those agencies and great minds are getting together to look at it after the fact. So that's the best outcome I could ask for is kind of a proactive approach. So thank you.
I agree, Representative O'Neill. And it does make intuitive sense to me that if an individual's involved in, quite frankly, irresponsible behavior with one vehicle, that there's probably a good argument to say that that behavior is consistent in terms of using other vehicles. And so I think it does feel like a good closing loop in terms of keeping our public safe, regardless of what vehicle that individual may be driving. Yeah. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative New, I want to really thank you for being on top of this and working with this. This is a tragic, was brought forth by a very tragic incident in your district. I know we had a lot of discussions about it last year. And from just to remind members, there's a lot of times we have a lot of bills that we pass, get signed into law. In the very next session, we have to deal with something that was overlooked. This bill is a very technical bill, and unfortunately sometimes minor little things get overlooked, and sometimes they're not minor that get overlooked. So thank you for fixing this.
Indeed. Well said, Representative Johnson. Representative Nash, I believe we're ready for your motion to
I'll move the A1, sure.
Representative Ash moves adoption of the A1 amendment. Representative, if we can just talk through quickly that amendment.
Sure. The A1 amendment, it's simply we had missed, specifically regarding boating and motorboats, we had missed the refusal of a sobriety test. So we want to make sure that that's covered as well, that it's not just if you fail, but if you refuse to take a test as well. So that's what the A1 will cover.
Very well. Are there any questions on the amendment? If not, then Representative Nash moves adoption of the A1 amendment. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Is there anyone else in the audience that wishes to testify for or against this bill? If not, then Representative Nguyen, any final words? I always try to have the author offer final words if they choose.
Absolutely. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Nope, I have nothing to add. I would just appreciate your support on the bill. Thank you, members.
Very well. So, members, the chair will then lay House File 1263 over for possible inclusion in our omnibus bill. Thank you, Representative New, Colonel Smith, and I'm sorry.
Christian Franzen.
Franzen, Mr. Franzen, of course. Thank you.
Yes.
Okay. Very well, members, we're going to move to House File 50. And then the chair calls up Representative Chairman Frank Horsley. Just hands free.
Mr. Chair, I would actually move House File 50 before us. And does this then go back to Ways and Means?
This will be referred to the Judiciary Committee.
Judiciary, and that this be referred to Judiciary Committee.
All right, very well. Representative Horsting, House File 50 is before us. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. I know that I have an author's amendment. I'm not sure if you want to address that first or you want me to get to the main body of the bill. Whatever the chair and the committee desire would be, I will follow your lead, Mr. Chair.
Chairman Horsley, why don't we move your amendment? Because this is going to put the bill in the shape that you want it before us.
Sure. It's A5 amendment, Mr. Chair. And I could address that if you'd like.
Very well. Representative Dane, would you care to move the A5 amendment?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'll move the author's A5 amendment.
Very well. The A5 amendment is before us. Representative Horsley, if you could describe the A5 amendment, and then I believe there's an amendment to the amendment.
Sure.
That we'll take up if it's offered.
Okay.
Offered.
Well, thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for hearing House File 50 and the accompanying amendment. I think many of you are familiar with the hands-free bill. It passed this committee last year. It has been vetted by a number of other committees as well. But in the course of the public discussion of this, some issues had come up around the need to get some additional data on traffic stops as it relates to this legislation if enacted. And so the A5 is an amendment that will collect data, a demographic type of data related to traffic stops that the state patrol is involved with. And it calls for a study both before the enactment of the bill and after so that there can be some comparative data. And so that's the goal of the A5 amendment.
Very well. Representative Ash?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have questions on the amendment, but I would also move the amendment to the amendment, the A6.
Very well. Representative Ash moves the A6 amendment. Representative Ash.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Hornstein, you and I have spoken about this bill, but not on this particular amendment. And I just have some concerns. One, in creating this study, there's going to be a cost. There's no assessment of that cost of collecting this data, storing this data. Who's going to create, manage, and administer the database that this goes into? And we've all seen, without being very proud of how it's been done, how MNLARS has worked, and this would be a department project that would be probably administered and built by minute, so be very afraid of that. But I find some of the things that you're collecting, I'm surprised that you're collecting those pieces of information, but some of the things that are missing that I think my amendment to your amendment would fix would also be the immigration status of people who are being stopped. Because obviously some of them may not even have driver's licenses, so we're going to want to collect that, Representative Hornstein and members. I think that that's an appropriate thing. So the amendment to the amendment would ask immigration status and collect that and hopefully put it into a database that somebody other than Minute would build if your amendment is engrossed. And I would request a roll call.
The roll call has been asked on the A6 amendment. I'm wondering if Commissioner Harrington, Paul Santi, if you can come forward. There's a question. There were two issues you put on the table just now with the Senate, if I heard you correct. One is the broader issue of data collection. And I think we have an expert here who can tell us about, you know, what that universe looks like. And then there's the issue of the A6 amendment itself. But welcome to the committee, Commissioner.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, John Harrington, Department of Public Safety Commissioner. Thank you very much for the invitation.
Commissioner, I'm wondering if you can describe for the committee what the data parameters are, realities are, relative to this kind of collection, whether it's currently existing, what our capacity is, and then also, I think Representative Nash, you had a very specific point around Minute. And I'll let you restate that.
Sure.
If that's okay.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And to the Commissioner, this is data that you're going to be collecting that you currently do not collect, correct?
Most of this data, Mr. Chairman, yes, this is mostly data that we do not collect currently.
And Mr. Chairman, to that end, this data is going to have to be stored in some database. You're going to have to make changes to either an existing database or create a new database. And I think, Representative Hornstein, you're requiring that this be a new project, so it would ostensibly go into a new database. And again, caution all of the members here, be deathly afraid of that. But again, the things that you put in your amendment that I'm trying to amend seem incomplete if you're truly trying to track who is being stopped that is not utilizing a hands-free device. And this is a serious issue. If you're truly trying to find out who are the people not abiding by this law, if your bill becomes law, this is something that I would imagine everybody would be in favor of, making sure that we're tracking the immigration status so that you can know maybe who's not even supposed to be driving if they don't have a driver's license, or if they do have a driver's license. You know, this is important stuff. So, members, I would ask for your support. And just to remind, I did ask for a roll call.
Of course. Very well. Commissioner Harrington, this is probably an appropriate time to then talk about the A6 amendment as well. I don't know if you had a chance to look at it, if you have it before you.
Mr. Chair, yes, I have seen the A6 amendment. I have had a chance to look at it and give it some consideration. And in my opinion, as a police professional, having served for over 40 years, this is not information that would lend itself to increased safety in the state of Minnesota. It is not information that police departments who currently do data collection around traffic stops collect. I do not see how this would be relevant to especially to this particular hands-free bill.
Well, Mr. Chairman. Thank you, Mr. Chair. If by your own admission the data that Representative Hornstein's author's amendment is data you do not collect, and you're also saying that mine does not either, I fail to see the relevance of his and not mine. So I'm again urging members to consider the A6 amendment and engross it, because you're already telling us that the other data he wants to collect is germane, but you're saying that mine is not. I find that to be a pretty stark juxtaposition. And you know, and moreover, I still haven't heard an answer as to who's going to be administering this large database. And moreover, I'm deeply concerned by the potential fiscal impact to our law enforcement across the state. You've got counties who are now going to be collecting way more data, post-processing that, handling that once they get back to their headquarters. You're actually layering costs onto these law enforcement professionals, and I think that that's clearly something that you haven't thought through.
Representative Hornstein.
Mr. Chair, I wanted to also address Representative Nash's concerns, and I think Commissioner Harrington can as well. But just to clarify a few things, because there's a little bit of misunderstanding about the amendment. It's my understanding that much of information about traffic stops is already being collected by the State Patrol through an electronic database that they, an existing database that they have. And so we're just asking for a little bit more information. So that's number one. Number two, for a limited amount of time, a matter of months. Number two, Mr. Chair and members, the state patrol officers, as well as you know, this kind of data collection is now done routinely as a matter of course in both Minneapolis and St. Paul, actually much more data than we're requiring on this amendment. But officers are not asking, this is very important, Mr. Chair and Representative Nass, officers are not asking the individual who's being stopped for any information. They are making the assessment themselves. So there's a huge difference between what we're asking for in this amendment and what's being asked for in the amendment to the amendment. There's not interaction on demographics that officers are asking people at a traffic stop in the A5 amendment. But and under Mr. Representative Nash's amendment, there is actually going to be this interaction literally asking someone their immigration status. So we can get into some of the other safety issues around that question being asked and why that's problematic. But I just wanted to make sure that, Mr. Chair and the committee, you knew the difference between what we're asking for in my amendment and what Representative Nash is talking about.
Commissioner Harrington.
Mr. Chair, in point of fact, the Minnesota State Patrol uses an e-citation method of collecting data on all traffic stops. What this information would be, we have empty fields that are in the e-citation system currently, and what this bill would do was we would use those empty fields in an already existing database to capture this amount of data. So there is not a new database or a new IT system that is necessary. My experience, both in my last employment at Metro Transit and prior to that in St. Paul, is that the database systems already exist. They're robust enough. And then it's simply a matter of cutting the data out for a limited period of time to be able to make a reasonable judgment and study and summarize what you got from the collection on the road. So there should be no impact on Minnesota county sheriffs or county administrations. This really should have no impact fiscally because the data already will be there, and it's simply a matter of us using already existing systems to capture that data.
Very well. Representative Nash.
Well, Mr. Chair, not to belabor the point, but anytime you collect additional data, it creates additional work, and additional work incurs additional cost. That's just an incontrovertible fact. So to say that it has no fiscal impact is just plain wrong. So respectfully, I urge members, you know, you should either, if you're going to vote my amendment down, you should also vote Representative Hornstein's down, because it's creating an undue burden on counties and the State Patrol. And you're creating new data. You have no consideration of cost, because it will incur additional costs. So thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Nash. We are hearing directly from the Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety on how this works and the existing framework that and methodology that even includes empty fields. It does stretch my imagination to think that there would be a cost to that. We do have more questioners. Representative Lucero.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I was initially struck with, I thought the first part of the conversation was from the commissioner said that they don't currently collect this information. And then I thought I understood the chair to say, or the bill author to say they do collect this information. It wouldn't be that hard. So that was, but yeah, if you could clarify that. But then I guess my question comes to, on the amendment, you had spoken about the method of collection. And I'm seeing here, not the amendment to the amendment, but the original amendment. On line 2.14 through 2.17, it says, the Minnesota State Patrol shall rely on their own observation to collect these different demographics. And then the commissioner mentioned an e-ticket system. So my first question then is not the information that's collected by observation of the officer, is it not going to be de-identified? It would be collected as part of identified information in an e-ticket system?
Chair, Commissioner. Representative Lucero, yes, it would be collected as part of the e-citation system. And when I said that some of the data is collected, some of the data is not. So, for example, the location of the traffic stop is currently collected on the e-citation system. The time of the traffic stop is currently collected on the e-citation system. Currently, the observation by the state trooper as to the race of the driver is not collected as part of the e-citation system, but is an empty field, and so it's simply a matter of them adding that field onto the e-citation so that it can be collected.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then the commissioner stated in regards to the amendment to the amendment that it was the opinion of the commissioner that immigration status would not be relevant to the safety, public safety, as the reasoning to speak against the amendment to the amendment. Well, if the immigration status is not germane to the safety, I would beg to differ with potential uninsured motorists driving. But if immigration status is not relevant to public safety, how is the ethnicity of somebody relevant to public safety? And would you share the same opinion then, that ethnicity wouldn't be, or race wouldn't be relevant?
Commissioner. Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero, it is my opinion that collecting demographic data gives a much richer background for who is driving on the state of Minnesota roads and gives us a better way of assessing how we would do education and prevention activities in that regard. Whether they are here with, as a current resident or not does not really impact that one way or another. So in my mind, it is not germane to increasing or, in fact, germane to reducing the number of people who are driving with an electronic device in their hands as to where they came from originally or what their immigration status is.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And then another question for the bill author. So the going back to that same section on the original amendment, it says personal observation. Then I can presume that there wouldn't be any questions asked by the law enforcement officer to the motor vehicle driver. But if they did ask a question, could the person refuse to answer? And if they refused to answer, would they be violating the law by not cooperating with the law enforcement officer?
Mr. Chair and Representative Lucero, so to the first question you asked before this question, that I wanted to address because you asked, the reason that this is, existing, we're looking at an existing framework is that e-citation network. So that's already in existence. So I wanted to address that question first. Secondly, I'll just defer to, Commissioner Harrington on, the nuances of the interaction between law enforcement and folks that get stopped at for a traffic stop in terms of the kinds of questions that are asked and how that would relate to the study. If that's okay, Mr. Chair.
Yes, of course. And specifically, Commissioner, I'm a little turned around here on the question because I don't think the issue on the table is the creation of a violation of law by virtue of making an observation. The demographics of the driver here. But please, Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lucero, if I understand your question right, if a trooper was to ask questions while during a traffic stop and the person declined to answer, I do not believe that that would be a violation of statute. Outside of the context of implied consent and some of the other areas where we have very specifically, and so you're required to provide identification, proof of insurance, these kind of things, the trooper would be able to ask those questions. And if there were not satisfactory or if there was a refusal to give those information, those laws would then be in place. But if we were asking a question about ethnicity or age, which should be on the driver's license, once again, that would not be prohibited by any other statutory law. And so I do not see that as a secondary violation.
Representative,
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And as I'm looking at the amendment to amendment, and I'm looking at the original amendment, on line 1.6, the amendment to amendment says delete citizens. And I actually don't think we could delete citizens without deleting the of in front of it. But I think this amendment to the amendment should be divided. And between line 1.3 and 1.4, and I would recommend that we approve line, the first half of that would change line 1.6 to shall oversee a study on traffic stops to determine, and just remove citizens, because in many ways, as we begin to use the term citizen, then we begin to get into that notion, well, are they a documented citizen? What do we mean by that? And I think if we remove that completely of citizens, we sort of go beyond that. And but I would request that we divide the amendment to the amendment and take up these two issues separately.
Very well. Representative Dean moves to divide the A6 amendment between lines 1.3 and 1.4. I'm going to turn to our legal counsel to make sure I'm correctly stating that. And then Representative Dean asked that we act on the first part of that amendment.
Correct.
First. Are we clear, members? Discussion.
Mr. Chair, if you could have legal counsel walk through what the implications of that division is.
Certainly. Legal counsel can walk through the division so that we're all clear about what the division does, or where the division is.
Mr. Chair, members, the motion would be to divide between lines 1.3 and 1.4 on the amendment to the amendment. The effect would be to create two separate amendments. The first amendment would be to delete the word citizens. The second amendment would be to make the other changes in that amendment to the amendment.
And let me, Representative Dean, I think we're not quite capturing this. There's a technical issue with the word of.
Yeah, Mr. Chair, I find it difficult to just delete the word citizen, because it would actually read then, shall oversee a study on traffic stops of to determine. So I think we should include the of just sort of as an oral amendment to the amendment, if that's possible, because it just makes sense as far as statutorily to have it read exactly how we want it to read.
Chairman Dean, the chair does find that that's a minor and technical amendment or addition to this amendment. And so I will allow that, and so perhaps I can have legal counsel then go through it again for us.
Mr. Chair, members, it would mean that it would read at line 1.3 of the amendment it would read page 1, line 6, delete, quote, the new language of citizens, end quote. That would be one amendment. The second amendment would be the remainder from page 1, line 4 through page 1, line 8.
And Representative Dean, the effect of that would be that any stop of any individual that would be involved here.
Right. Which, Mr. Chair, I believe was the author's intent of any stop of any individual.
Representative Hornstein, is that correct?
Representative Dean is correct.
Very well. Mr. Chair. So, hold on. So, members, so we're going to vote on the first part of the divided amendment, and Representative Lucero on this point.
Yeah, exactly. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just I want to make sure I understand. So my understanding of if an amendment is divisible, it has to each part has to stand on its own. And based on the conversation that just took place, it would not be divisible because each part doesn't stand on its own. But then the amendment, it's actually an amendment to the amendment to the amendment. And I'm not sure that's in order.
Representative Lucero, I've been told by legal counsel that it's not an amendment to amendment to amendment. It's a division of an amendment to amendment, and that is in order. But to your first question, whether or not these two pieces can stand alone, I will ask legal counsel's opinion on that.
Uh, Mr. Chair and members, I believe this ultimately is your decision about whether or not, but the advice that I can give is that the deletion of the phrase of citizens would not directly affect the changes made on the other lines in the amendment. It's possible. That's all.
And so, members, the chair finds that both provisions do stand on their own. Further questions on the first part of the amendment? All right. If not, then all in favor of the lines 1.1 through 1.2.
Mr. Chair, just a quick question.
Representative Lucero,
was there a roll call on the amendment to the amendment, so wouldn't the roll call stand on each on the division as well?
I would think not, but I'm certainly open to a roll call request.
So moved, Madam, Mr. Chair.
Representative Lucero asked for a roll call on the first part of the divided amendment. This is starting to get a little, it's kind of fun. All right, so members, we're voting on 1.1 through 1.3, which is the first part of the divided amendment. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Roll call.
Yes, for you.
The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani.
Yes.
Christensen. Considine.
No.
Dean.
Yes.
Edelson.
Yes.
Grossel.
No.
Howard.
Yes.
Johnson.
Yes.
Lesh. Absent. Long.
Yes.
Lucero.
Yes.
Miller?
Yes.
No. Miller, Moeller.
Sorry, I forgot there was a Miller.
Miller? No. Moeller?
Yes.
Nash?
Nope.
O'Neill?
No.
Pinto?
Yes.
Poston?
No.
At a vote of 10 ayes and 6 nays, the motion prevails. We now have the second part of the amendment before us, which is lines 1.4 and 1.8. Discussion. I do have a list of folks. Is the list to these? So then, Representative Law.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Harrington, you addressed the public safety issue around whether or not this language would be relevant to texting while driving. I'm curious about the broader public safety implications of asking about immigration status. It's my understanding that immigration enforcement is the province of the federal government and not the state highway patrol, and that asking about immigration status could have negative consequences for individuals' trust of police and their willingness to report crimes or be witnesses to crimes, and wondering if that is an opinion you share, or if you have concerns about the public safety implications of asking about immigration status.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Long, in my 40 years of policing, we have learned many things about enforcement of immigration. You are absolutely correct that immigration enforcement is the province of the United States federal government, and it is not in the province of local, state, or county police, and so it does not appropriately belong within the province of the Minnesota State Patrol. In addition to that, it has also been our experience that inquiring into immigration status has a chilling effect on victims of crime and witnesses of crime, and those are the folks that we, in fact, have to depend on in order to get information about criminal activity and the threats to our safety. And so asking about immigration status on a broad basis where it's not relevant to a particular criminal activity such as human trafficking or illegal narcotics trafficking, asking outside of that has had a negative effect in terms of providing information that police and public safety officials can rely on to keep us all safe.
Representative Law? Representative Mueller? No? Oh, I'm sorry, Representative Miller. One letter makes a difference.
We look a lot alike. So, Mr. Chair, thank you. And just as a quick pause, I have a question as to the bill itself, so I can ask that after this or I can wait till later. I just don't want to add confusion.
Why don't
there.
We do it after? I'll make sure
no
that
problem,
you're on the list for that.
I do have something to this, though, real quick. And thank you, Mr. Chair. And so I'm supporting basically the amendment to the amendment from Representative Nash, and it's a consistency thing. I heard that it's the opinion of the officer, and then it's a goal to make roads safer. Okay, I get that part. But then everything that you just said contradicts lines 1.15 and lines 1.16, where it says race, ethnicity, or both of the driver and the gender of the driver. I guess I'm confused by a couple things I'd like you to address. How the gender of the driver is important to know how safe the roads are. I mean, if we find out that there's more men than women that are texting while driving, we change the law to reflect so that men can't do certain things and women can. And then with the race and ethnicity of a driver, that's sort of stunning to me that we're going to actually, if there's one conversation we've had in society in the last couple of years, we've got to stop profiling people. And now we're going to purposely profile people off of this study. We're going to ask an officer to determine you are this race or you are this ethnicity, and I'm going to record that. And actually, with this information, I assume there's going to be a name attached to this. Now, you may scrub that out when you do analysis, but we're running information based off of someone's what happens if there's a specific race that is off the charts in texting while driving. What exactly are you going to do to that, and how does that improve safety of driving? So I can get your argument of why you don't include. I don't totally agree with it, but I can get the country of origin and nationality, that sort of stuff. But if you're going to be consistent with that argument, then certainly you can include number 3 and 4 on that list. So I'm not quite understanding why you're saying one and doing another. If you could clarify that for me.
Commissioner.
Chairman, Representative Miller.
Okay.
I'm going to get this right before it's all over with. The issue of racial profiling, I think, is an important one. But the term racial profiling really speaks to the issue of officers using the race of the driver as a rationale for making the stop. And what this does is simply record the race of the driver after a lawful stop that was race neutral and essentially race blind. So I do not believe that what this bill will do is increase racial profiling. What it will do is it will provide additional information so that the Minnesota Highway Patrol and the Traffic Safety Council and others can do a better job of addressing concerns by community about whether there is racial profiling. And it will also allow us, for example, in the case of gender, it may also allow us to do a better job in our prevention and educational activities. That if we know the background and the demographics of the drivers who are most frequently texting while driving, can we not apply that as we are approaching schools, doing our general advertising, as we're trying to design prevention activities, we'll be able to tailor those educational activities to the specific group that is the most often offending. Now, it may well be that this is, in fact, a universal offense and there is no spikes in there, in which case our general approach, which we're using now, which is sort of a general approach to say everyone should act safely, makes sense. But with additional demographic information, we will be able to tailor make some of our educational approaches. It will not change our enforcement approach. Enforcement has to be based on behavior. That's the gold standard for police enforcement, is that what we do is based on the behaviors that we observed, not on the race, ethnicity, or gender of the person who's actually committing the offense.
Thank you. One more quick question, Mr.
Please,
Chair. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, I hear what you're saying, but let me play that out. Let's say Representative Hornstein gets pulled over because he just can't stop watching YouTube while he's driving down the road, okay?
I don't drive, Mr. Chair.
Play with me. He would be on the green line mostly if that was
the case. And the officer puts in that I had a Jewish driver, because determination is, it's a good guess, right? I love you, Representative Hornstein. You know that, right? But let's say it puts in, now let's say that there's a trend that, the way I'm hearing this, so please tell me if I'm looking at this wrong, the way I'm hearing this is, what if there's a trend that there's Jewish drivers that have a problem watching YouTube while they're driving down the road, okay? I'm not saying that's the case, but I'm throwing out the hypothetical. And you come back and you had said, well, we need to modify education and stuff based on the information that we receive. How are you not holding people who are Jewish at a deferential treatment of the law based on their race? So when you say that someone is not going to be, the law is not going to be held differently before them based on race, or race, ethnicity, or gender, okay, I'm not hearing that, because you're saying you may have to change the education and how you train people. Now, I understand the validity of the fact that we're probably not going to see that trend, okay? But we are going to see other trends, otherwise you wouldn't be measuring this. And you just told me that you're going to change your education models based off of what you see those trends. Is that going to be education for the driver, education for the police? Who exactly is that education for?
Mr. Chair, Representative Miller, I think I appreciate your clarification, because when I say education, what I am talking about is education for the drivers. So given your example, what I would then suggest is that if there was a spike that showed that Jewish drivers were driving distracted more often, then where would I go to have the most educational impact to make sure we're informing them about the fact that by driving distracted, they are 23 times more at risk than if they were not driving distracted? Could I not go to synagogues? Could I not go to Jewish community schools to have that conversation? And it's not an enforcement activity. It's an educational activity to cause them to change their behavior by simply making them better informed drivers on the road. So this will not have an impact on enforcement, but what we hope to have is an impact on the behaviors, and thereby, by reducing the behaviors, we reduce the crashes, and that makes all of us much safer.
Okay, just one final comment, Mr. Chair, and I'll be done.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, we're spending, I haven't looked at the clock, but probably half an hour on an amendment to an amendment and an amendment. I would encourage, and I actually forget, who is the amendment from you? Representative,
yes.
Hornstein, okay. I would encourage Representative Hornstein, a lot of times in committees, this is the place to do it, to maybe go back and work on it. And so maybe if he would consider, because it's moving to other places, right? It's moving to judiciary, I believe, Mr. Chair?
I believe so.
If perhaps the amendment itself, if we can just kind of hold it off and have that readdress another committee with some of these things that can be addressed a little bit better, because I frankly don't see the clarity in it. And I think the fact that we're creating roll calls and 35, 40 minutes of discussion is indicative of that. So that's my recommendation. I'll let you do. I'll respect whatever you do, but that's my recommendation.
Representative Hornstein, it is the chair's intent to have us vote on this amendment.
Yeah.
It is the chair's intent to have us vote on this bill. It is will be up to the committee to see whether this bill moves forward. At that point, then it's the next committee's duty to work it further. And so I, you know, quite frankly, Representative Hornstein, that's the chair's intent. Commissioner, let me ask you three questions, if I might, very quickly. In the last generation, there has been concern about racial profiling, not just here, but all across the country. Is racial profiling, in fact, something that law enforcement understands as a reality and takes seriously?
Mr. Chair, absolutely. Racial profiling, dating back to studies done out in New Jersey and all over the United States, has definitely been a concern for policing. And we spent years and years essentially training officers to make sure that our policing was race neutral and was blind, essentially. To that point, the Minnesota Post Board requires every police officer that goes through post standards to be trained in procedural justice. We require them all to go through implicit bias training, all of which are supplements to teaching them about the gold standard and the ethical standards of policing, where race cannot be a variable in making decisions either to pull a car over or to take enforcement action. So it is absolutely a concern that has longstanding in police and peace and public safety, and continues to be a concern in public safety conversations and criminal justice conversations.
So, Commissioner, it seems to me that as we move to address that, we're not addressing a mythical thing. Racial profiling is an issue. We can agree or disagree to what degree, the nature, whatever. But it seems to me that racial profiling is an issue in the state of Minnesota. Am I correct with that?
Mr. Chair, that is absolutely correct. Even my most recent position as chief of police at Metro Transit, it became a issue there. And this response is very similar to the response that we crafted at Metro Transit of collecting data so that we could do a better job of both educating the officers, training the officers, I guess is probably a more appropriate way of describing it, but also making sure that we educated our passengers as to what they could reasonably expect from police when they were being stopped.
And Commissioner, I want to thank you for your work in that regard. When you were head of our transit, my understanding is that that has fostered a level of community ownership and participation, which is what we want from our law enforcement activities. With that, I'm going to continue with, we have several other questions. Representative Grossel.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And thank you, Commissioner, for making that statement earlier about our LEOs being supposed to be race neutral and blind when we're dealing with these things. I caught a little flack the other day for saying that same thing. Apparently, people don't believe me, but I hope they believe you. So thank you for bringing that out again. You know, you talk about the the federal agencies. As state law enforcement agents, I am a retired deputy sheriff, and we are to cooperate with our federal law enforcement agencies as well, are we not?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grossel, yes, that's true. Grossel, sorry.
Grossel.
Grossel, sorry.
That's okay. I've been people having trouble with my name since I was a little kid. So this just goes by. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Very well, thank you, Representative Grossel.
Representative Buller.
Representative Jackson.
So when we're...
Sorry, I thought you were done, Representative.
Oh.
My apologies.
You keep doing that to me, Mr. Chair.
I know. No. You and I, we're going to connect, man. Representative Russell, please.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, Commissioner, I guess the amendment to the amendment, how would that not be helpful in making sure that we ensure that we keep that cooperation between agencies to help each other in these things? Because over my years in law enforcement, I've made several traffic stops in the middle of the night and have found out that the individual inside of the vehicle is without a Minnesota driver's license, is without a passport or a work visa or anything. They're here illegally. And I've had to hold them for Border Patrol or someone to come and take care of these individuals. I guess, why wouldn't this information help in this data to make sure that we have the best people or the safest people driving on the roads?
Mr. Chair, Representative Grossel. In my experience, first of all, the Immigration Enforcement Act that most folks are in violation of is a civil act. It is not a criminal act, and as a consequence, it is a blending or a blurring of the line to say that police officers who are investigating a criminal infraction should, in fact, be substituting themselves in to be doing civil enforcement for the federal government. So in addition to that, my experience, at least in the last 20 years, has been that most departments have found that if they call the duty officer back in those days when we did, that the United States government was absolutely not interested in someone who had a driver's license violation. They were only interested if this was relevant to a significant criminal violent crime. And as I said, with the rare exception of where you're investigating a violent crime where immigration status is relevant to that crime, I find that it has a reverse effect by asking that question to the general public. Asking that question will cause you to have people withdraw, not give you more information, and that makes us less safe. And in any case, the civil violation of overstaying a visa or that doesn't really have any impact on whether or not they had a phone in their hand while they were driving and thereby might crash into somebody. Their immigration status, I do not believe, is relevant to that particular investigation.
Thank you. Thank you, Commissioner.
Senator Grassl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In a normal traffic stop, I mean, the first thing I'm going to ask for is do you know why I stopped you? And wait for their response, and then I'll ask them for their license and their insurance information. And through this traffic stop, if I stop them for that hands-free violation, I am going to come to this point to where things just aren't adding up here. They don't have a license. They don't have any kind of ID or information. So I don't know how things are done in St. Paul, but if we don't have that information, we're holding on to them until we can figure out, okay, who am I dealing with here? Now, on the flip side of that, they're also, in dealing with someone who is in the country illegally, I've bought multiple times methamphetamines while working undercover from people who are here illegally and trafficking large amounts of methamphetamine to the three reservations, Red Lake, Leech Lake, and White Earth reservations, and all the counties around there where I was a law enforcement officer. And, you know, there's some lines in there that if we are going to be making these traffic stops, you're going to be doing these investigatory stops while you're working through the process of a regular traffic stop for a violation of this kind, where you're going to gather this information. What are we supposed to do with it then?
Representative Grassl, I think there are citizens that traffic in methamphetamines and other illegal drugs as well. So I think we.
Oh yeah, no, those are, Mr. Chair. I'm just saying, as far as this amendment goes, to the amendment, you know, I've bought narcotics from countless numbers of people, both citizens and non-citizens. So I mean, I'm not saying that those are the only folks that are dealing that are transporting narcotics, but when it pertains to this amendment, I guess if we have that information, what are we supposed to do with it as LEOs?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Grassl, the standard that we would apply is the behavioral standard. So what behaviors are actionable in this case? You are required to have a driver's license. That's actionable. You're required to have insurance. That's actionable. Those are actionable. You're not allowed by the statute to have the phone in your hand or be watching your YouTube videos in the front seat of the car. Those are also actionable. Whether you're doing that having been born in Bemidji or Belize is not actionable. What I would say is that I would take action on the behaviors that I observed, which is I asked you for the driver's license. You didn't have a driver's license. I would take my normal procedures for what do I do with someone who doesn't have a driver's license, whether they don't have a driver's license because they have not paid their fines and the driver's license has been revoked because of that reason, whether they don't have a driver's license because they're underage and they have not acquired a driver's license or their driver's license expired. I would simply take action based on the behaviors that I observed, and I do not believe that their immigration status is relevant to that particular behavior. And that's what I could take action on legally.
Members.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Grassl. Members, we have public testimony, I believe. Representative Hornstein from families have been impacted adversely and perhaps tragically as a result of the behavior that this bill attempts to address. I want to honor their presence here today and make sure that we get to their testimony today, now, as opposed to dragging them back into the evening. The rest of us, we're here. It's a 24/7 job, so we can do that. So with that, Representative Johnson, I'm going to have you ask your question, and then I want us to move. We will then move to a vote on this amendment. and then we'll move over to the testimony. Members, in 5 minutes, I'd like to get to the testimony of the public on this. Representative Johnson.
Mr. Chair, the question I had dealt with other things in the original amendment. That's how long ago I asked to ask the question, so I'll wait.
Well, very well then. Members, I'm going to then have us vote on the second part of this amendment. This is the 1.4 through 1.8. And is there a roll call asked for this?
Yes, there was.
Very well. Representative Nash, there is a roll call, so we will then take the roll on this amendment. The clerk will take the roll.
Chair Mariani?
No.
Christensen?
No.
Considine?
No.
Dean?
No.
Edelson?
No.
Grossel?
Yes.
Howard?
No.
Johnson?
Yes.
Flesch?
No.
Wong?
No.
Lucero?
Yes.
Miller?
Yes.
Moeller?
No.
Nash?
Yes.
O'Neill?
Yes.
Pinto?
No.
Holston?
Yes.
On a vote of 10 ayes and 7 nays, the, wait a minute.
10 nays.
I'm sorry, I have this backwards. On a vote of 10 nays and 7 ayes, the motion does not prevail. Pardon?
At the underline.
Right, so are we done with the amendment?
No, we have another.
Okay. All right. With that, members, I'm going to move to the to honor our guests here. We will come back then to the.
Going to move the amendment.
Oh, very well. So, who made the initial motion? This is so
Dean.
Representative Dean renews his motion.
Mr. Chair.
To adopt the A5 amendment as amended.
Mr. Chair, the original amendment is what I'd like to add some questions on. I wanted to wait until we got to the original amendment.
Representative Johnson, I will allow us to have 5 minutes to do that. It is my very serious intent to honor the testimony of the public here while they are here. So please, you have 5 minutes, so keep that in mind, please. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, earlier, I'm not sure how long ago, it was brought up that there'd be no real impact to the State Patrol and the Sheriff's Office and the Police Department to make these fields and do the programming so they can do this 4-month study. That's actually not going to be enough time to actually do a study, a proper study, to even find out what's going on. It's too short a time period. But all these programs with the e-citations, they're not owned by the state. Each department owns theirs. That means they're going to have a tech come in every one of our 500-600 law enforcement agencies to set up all these programs. This is a huge cost and a huge burden to our law enforcement agencies across the state. We already have a huge burden. We forced them years ago after September 11th, or no, it wasn't September 11th, it was after the bridge collapse, to go to the armor system, which is an 800 megahertz radio system for better communications. Our counties and cities are paying thousands of dollars every year for multiple updates because we went to that. This is going to be another burden on them fiscally to do these, spend a few thousand dollars to put these upgrades in for every single department in the state of Minnesota for a 4-month study to get this information in, which goes to the, which then will have to be shipped to the, pulled out taking time to pull all this information out and sending it back to the commissioner. So I think this is a big undue burden on our law enforcement agencies to begin with. With a four-month study, you're not going to get enough proper information to find out if there's actually anything going on. I would vote no against this amendment.
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair. Johnson. The intent behind this was simply to have State Patrol collect this data on State Patrol traffic stops. It was not, in my understanding as I read the bill, this is not a mandate for all police agencies in the state of Minnesota to collect the data. It is simply a mandate for the Minnesota Highway Patrol to collect the data. And so this would only impact the e-citation system that Minnesota Highway Patrol operates under currently.
Representative Johnson, I want to ask our legal counsel to clarify what the amendment does in terms of who's responsible for collecting this data. Mr.
Chair, members, it puts a responsibility on the Department, the State Patrol. So the Department of Public Safety, working with Minnesota State Patrol, collect this data. Only the Minnesota State Patrol is required to collect the data. And paragraph E at line 2.5 through 2.8, there is permission for the Commissioner of Public Safety to request other relevant data from law enforcement agencies who decide to participate, but there is no requirement that other law enforcement agencies participate.
I'm good with that, but I would request a roll call on this.
Very well. Representative Johnson requests a roll call on this. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I have some concerns with the language, and I'm going to be very specific and pointed. Specifically about, we heard the communication about that this is an observation of race, and so that's the misidentification of race is just, I mean, it's just a huge issue, right? So, you know, you look around the table right here. I myself travel. And I've traveled to every continent except Australia and Antarctica. And on every continent I've been on, I've been misidentified. In fact, I've rarely been identified as my true race. I'm not sure why, but when I was in India, they thought I was Brahmin Indian, which was wonderful. That's a beautiful thing. When I was in Ethiopia, they thought I was Japanese. When I was in Colombia, they thought I was Colombian, Latina. So, and my colleague to my left is misidentified at almost every hearing that we talk about race. It is assumed by his skin color that he is Caucasian, he is not. So I have a great concern. Unless you ask someone their race or ethnicity, you will not know. Because we are so mixed and so varied. In this room alone, there are a multitude of races and ethnicities. So I don't see how that's helpful or accurate, and I am always fair and accurate, and it's not going to be either one, because if you are just by observation looking at someone, you are going to misidentify them. I myself have family members. I have a beautiful niece who's married to a gentleman from Trinidad Tobago, and their children are of mixed race. I have another nephew who's married to an African-American and Native American woman mix, and their children are a mix, and you can look at them and you don't know. They're just a mix of a lot of different things, from Scandinavian to, you know, to African American to Native. So I have a big problem with even having this in here, because you are going to misidentify more people than you're going to identify. Second thing, on line 1.16, you use the word gender. Now, gender means something very different than sex. Okay, we just had a very long hearing about that in the previous committee in judiciary. Now, on your driver's license, which I have mine renewed just this last summer, it says sex, it does not say gender. Sex is defined in law. Gender is not. There is no definition of gender. So we are talking about something completely different. If you mean sex, then you need to say sex. If you mean gender, then that's undefined and there is no statutory definition of gender. So that's a totally, utterly different thing. I think we just need to know what we're talking about. So one, I have a big problem with an observational determination of someone's race or ethnicity, because you're going to misidentify the vast majority. And it's, and I'm not really sure what value that is, as we've already stated, but I'm mostly in concern about the misidentification, as I have been misidentified my entire life. I've been, like I said, even mistaken for Japanese, which was the most interesting. And on your driver's license, it does not say gender, it says sex. And on your driver's license, it does not say your race or ethnicity. Okay? So the only way to really know someone's gender is to ask them, because that's a self-identified, not an observational determination. And it is impossible to know someone's race or ethnicity without asking them. So either we're going to ask or we're not. And so we need to decide what we're going to do and put that into the amendment. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Hornstein, I want to thank you for taking this amendment, because I'm the one who pushed you to take it. And it seems to me that what perhaps the chair has not done well in this session is not to have had a very early conversation about racial profiling. Obviously a salient issue in our society today, and all sorts of people want to get it right. But we can't get right what we don't understand. You know, it was not my intent to capture a quantitative measurement of who is being stopped, as much as to understand how and whether bias is playing a role in who does get stopped. And in order to know that, it seems to me that the observation of the person making the stop is critically important, that it is the perception of the person making the stop, that the information about that person's perception that then sets up the opportunity for us to have the conversation, the learning, and the adjustment of our professional practices so that, in fact, there are no biases that are the leading factor why someone would get stopped. As a brown guy, believe me, you know, throughout my whole life, I've had people think I'm white, I've had people think I'm brown, I've had people think I'm black. For a while, when I was real young, they thought I was Pakistani. The fact that I wore dashikis all the time, you know, probably contributed to that, you know. And so I understand that who I am truly was not the issue in terms of what people thought. It was important for me to know what they thought and how that judged their interaction with me. That goes to the essence of racial profiling. And so, Representative O'Neill, I appreciate your observations. I apologize to you and to the committee for not having the much fuller conversation that I think this committee should have had prior to this kind of hearing. And you have my word that we're going to have that kind of conversation in the coming year and a half that I've been privileged to chair this committee. With that, members, I do want to honor the public here, and so I'm going to move to a vote. The clerk will take the vote on the amendment, the A5 amendment, as amended.
Chair Mariani?
Yes.
Christensen? Christensen?
Yes.
Yes. Considine?
Yes.
Dean?
Yes.
Edelson?
Yes.
Grossel? Grossel? Howard?
Yes.
Johnson?
No.
Lesh?
Aye.
Wong?
Yes.
Lucero?
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 No.
Miller?
No.
Moeller?
Yes.
Nash? Nash?
Absent.
O'Neill?
No.
Pinto?
Yes.
Holston?
No.
Members, on a vote of 10 ayes, 5 noes, 2 absent, the motion does prevail. Thank you, Representative Horston. You have some testifiers, I believe.
Thank you.
Thank you, Commissioner.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members, for now.
Representative Hornstein, do you want to bring your testifiers up and then we'll try to move as expeditiously as possible? Why don't we begin with the first testifier while everyone continues to gather? And the format we use here is that we state our name for the record, and then we share our testimony.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Rhonda Maurer. I would like to thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak today. This is not my first time, nor will it be my last. My family has suffered unimaginable pain due to the growing epidemic of distracted driving. I, like most people, never thought it would affect my life. That is, until the evening of July 21st, 2015, when my Uncle Chuck, cousins Cassie, Alanita, and a family friend were on their way home from the Monticello Library. With a green light, my uncle followed traffic and entered an intersection. But he was struck by an extended cab, Ford F-150, traveling at 65 miles an hour before he even made it to the middle. There was no sounds of screeching tires, as no brakes were applied. The driver just flat out did not see the red light because she was not even looking at the road, even after multiple people in the vehicle had asked her to stop. The scene of the crash was chaotic, as there were 8 in total that were injured. 2 were airlifted, 6 were taken by ambulance to 3 different hospitals. By the time I reached the hospital, Chuck was already gone. I had the unfortunate experience of watching my cousin Patrick tell his little sister, who was just released from the hospital due to the same crash, that her dad didn't make it. I will never forget the heart-wrenching sound that echoed through the hospital corridor. When we went to see Cassie, she looked like she was sleeping. Besides the brain injuries, she only had a broken finger. We, however, were not allowed to touch or talk to her, as they didn't want us to stimulate her brain. 10 days after the crash and 4 days after we laid Chuck to rest, we were told there was nothing else they could do for Cassie. The multiple surgeries, including removing part of her skull to release the pressure from her brain, did not work. She no longer had any brain activity. She was 10. It was another loss my family should not have had to endure. It was a 3-letter word that took 2 people out of my life. Damn. D-A-M. That is all it took. The bill we are talking about today is far overdue. Something needs to be done, as the number of the crashes due to distracted driving continue to rise. We cannot allow this epidemic to continue taking the lives of our loved ones. Driving is a privilege, it is not a right. We need to get off of our phones while we are behind the wheel. It is our responsibility to make our roads safe. It is time for Minnesota to stand up and say enough is enough. We want to be able to get from A to B and not have to worry about the person behind us. Not have to worry about the person behind us on their phone not seeing us brake. or worry about the person next to us sideswiping us because they can't turn their head fully because they're holding their phone to their ear. I see it every day, no matter where I'm driving. Car goes over the white line, goes back over the yellow, back to the white, speeds up, slows down, because they are too engulfed in their phones. I am begging you to pass this bill, not for us sitting up here today, not for Julie, not for Megan, not for Penny, not for John, not for Cassie, and not for Chuck, but for you, for your family, for your friends. But most of all, I think we need to do it for Minnesota. I just want to get home at the end of the day. I just want to get to work at the beginning of my day. I don't want to have to worry about who's coming from where. I think it's time. Minnesota needs this bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Bauer. Please, sir.
Yes, thank you, Mr. Chairman. My name is John Hausladen, and I am president of the Minnesota Trucking Association. We're a statewide safety organization that represents 650 trucking companies and their allied vendors from across the state. I'm here today to be one of 35 statewide business and advocacy organizations, from truckers to grocers to the Minnesota Chamber, that have adopted policies supporting hands-free cell phone legislation. I'm here to tell you that the business community is united in the belief that it is time to pass hands-free cell phone legislation in Minnesota. Every day, Minnesota businesses are putting their people, who are husbands and fathers and mothers and daughters, they're putting their employees and their contractors on roadways filled with distracted drivers. And the results are alarming. The insurance industry reports that the only category of work-related injuries increasing today is motor vehicle accidents, and it's not a surprise. The data also shows that business and personal auto premiums are going up, and what's the common factor? Driving distracted and cell phone use. Now, professional truck drivers, they already operate in a one-touch, hands-free mode because it's a federal requirement. And I have to tell you, when we talk to our members and look at what we do to serve Minnesota and our customers, it has not hampered our ability to do it. But what our professional drivers see every day is quite alarming. Rather than focusing on the driving task, we see people looking at their phones. They're even watching videos. And professional truck drivers say, put down the phone, focus on the road. So the business community does look forward to passing House File 50 in 2019 and reducing distracted drivers for our people, for our employees and contractors, and all Minnesota motorists. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. Are there any questions of the testifiers? I do want to, I am humbled, Ms. Maurer, by your words. I'm humbled by your words, and I'm also sorry for the loss of your loved ones and for your neighbors who have come here as well. I appreciate you being here. I can't imagine the courage that it takes to be public and share your pain with us, but I do see that you do it out of love and care for all of us. And so I want to thank you humbly for your presence here today. Are there any questions or observations? Representative O'Neill.
Mr. Chair, I don't have a question, but I am the state representative for Monticello, Buffalo, and Maple Lake. And so I believe you said the Monticello Library is where they were leaving, that they left from?
Smaller.
So I just wanted to give you my condolences as well. And I'm pretty sure that whatever road they're on, it's probably a road that I've traveled multiple times. If they were leaving the Monticello Library, it's a road that I'm not sure which direction they were headed, but I'm sure it was one that I've traveled quite a bit, and I'm so sorry for your loss as well.
Representative Baller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I also wanted to thank you for coming and also recognize that we've been receiving on our committee a lot of emails from other families and survivors who aren't probably here in person with us. And one email struck me. It was someone's birthday today, I think, was one of the victims of distracted driving. It would have been his birthday today, and I just recall that email. So I just wanted to thank all of those families that have been emailing us who maybe weren't also able to be here in person today. So thank you.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein. Oh, I'm sorry. Representative Christensen. Representative Christensen, please.
And I will just pile on the thank yous here. You are the real reason we are here today and why the bill was written. So we got a little bit off track, and I'm sorry about that, but I appreciate you being here. And we won't forget you. This is a nonpartisan issue, and today it seemed partisan, but believe me, the letters I've gotten have been from everyone in my community. So I want to thank you very much, and I think this is the year something might work. Thanks.
Thank you for your testimony and your presence here today. Representative Hornstein, I believe we have a question for you. We never actually got you to go through your bill really quickly. So I want to give you an opportunity to do that, but I also know Representative Miller has a question. Representative Horst, it's probably appropriate for you to tell us what your bill does.
Sure. Thank you very much, Mr. Chair and members. So, first of all, House File 50 is an effort to reverse, as you heard, what has become an epidemic of distracted driving on our highways here in Minnesota. It's legislation that will prevent deaths and injuries on Minnesota highways. In recent years, there have been an average of 59 deaths and 223 serious injuries in our state due to distracted driving, and it's the fastest growing cause of fatal crashes in the state. We know bills like this work, members. They have in other states where crash rates have been significantly lowered. And I would say, just in summary, this bill saves lives. We know that. It's proven. And I'm happy to answer your questions. Basically, time is short, so I'm just going to summarize in just a few minutes what this bill does. I want to be clear. This is not a ban on cell phone use. It is a ban on handheld cell phone use. And, we allow the use of wireless communications and voice activation. And we allow cell phone calls and functions made with one-touch activation. And so there are some exceptions. If you want to use a handheld device for emergency assistance in the event of an immediate life or safety threat or danger, and an authorized emergency vehicle. But basically, to summarize, and I know people have questions, what can I do, what can't I do? It's very simple, members. You can't hold a cell phone while you're driving. That's pretty much this bill in a nutshell. And as I said, we have seen significant reductions in crash rates and fatalities and injuries in the 17 states and District of Columbia where this bill has been enacted.
Well, thank you, Representative Hornstein. Before we get to Representative Miller's question, I do want to ask if there's anyone in the audience who wishes to testify against the bill. Please come forward, sir. Please state your name for the record and give us your testimony.
Chairman, committee members, my name is Brett Collier. I'm from Big Lake, Minnesota, and I work as an engineering consultant in the nuclear industry. And I sit before you again simply as a concerned citizen. I thought we settled how we were not in favor of making it illegal to simply hold a phone in your hand while driving last session. I provided testimony last session pointing out that of the 74 distracted driving deaths that occurred in Minnesota in 2015, only two could be attributed to talking on the phone, And we don't even know if those two drivers were holding the phone to their ear or using hands-free technology. House File 50 proposes making it holding the phone in your hand illegal, subjecting the offender to what today would be a $50 fine for the first offense. This is the same fine that a person caught texting and driving today would receive, and the same fine that a person back in 2015 would have received if they were caught texting and driving. Did that threat of a $50 fine cause those drivers in 2015 to stop texting and driving? No. So let me ask you, if this proposed statute had been in place back in 2015, how many additional lives would it have saved? The answer is none. But the supporters of this bill somehow believe that making it illegal to even hold your phone in your hand will reduce distracted driving deaths. This makes no sense whatsoever. If a $50 fine doesn't stop a driver from texting then, why would it do so now? Last session, a representative from the Highway Patrol testified that they were in support of this bill because it would make it easier to hand out tickets, not having to prove in each instance that the person was texting or not. Making it easy is not the standard for passing a statute. Let's say we want to make it easy for the police to arrest drunk drivers. Should we stop administering breath tests and other sobriety tests? It would appear that with a 30% increase in texting and driving citations issued in 2018, that's 9,554 citations, which is an increase of 459% over 2012, when only 1,707 citations were handed out, that the police have been able to figure out how to more easily hand out these citations. Now to circle back to the beginning of my testimony, it's not the person talking on the phone that's causing distracted driving accidents, but the person texting with their eyes on their phone screen instead of the road. Some of the supporters of this bill will tell you that you just need to purchase and use a hands-free device, which is allowed by this bill. But even according to a recent Star Tribune article, a study from Queensland University of Technology in Australia found that talking on a cell phone with a hands-free device while driving is just as distracted as a conversation using a handheld phone. So if the supporters believe that holding the phone to your ear is a distraction that contributes to distracted driving deaths, and it's shown that the use of a hands-free device is just as distracting, why allow the use of a hands-free device in this bill?
Mr. Hillier, I'm going to interrupt, and I do apologize. There is another committee that's coming in here in a few minutes. I'll give you the option of whether you can wrap up in a minute or so. Otherwise, you can absolutely come back because we're going to reconvene later to finish.
I've got about this much left.
Very well, sir. If you can do it in a minute, I would be
I'll talk faster.
Thank you.
And this study came out in 2016, but what this tells me is that the legislative supporters of this bill are not so concerned about actual public safety, but that they want to look like they're concerned with public safety. The only thing that this bill will do is result in thousands of drivers being ticketed for performing an action that, per statistics, have shown to not be a major cause of distracted driving deaths, not even 3% of the 2015 deaths. This bill will only result in the issuance of thousands of tickets, collecting millions of dollars, creating a new revenue stream. There is another bill in the House, House File 104, that wishes to increase the current fine from $50 to at least $150, then up to $500 for the third offense, with the Senate version actually revoking your license for a period of time following the third offense. This is a sound and logical path that Minnesota should take. This is an increase in both penalty and deterrent for the actions that were actually causing distracted driving deaths. But let me remind you, if both the hands-free bill and the increase to these fines bill were to pass this session, you're going to be charging people who are simply holding their phones to their ears a penalty of at least $150 and possibly revoking their license for something that statistically is not a major contribution to distracted driving deaths. What the proponents are not telling you,
Mr. Hillier,
I
do have the other committee actually already in the room now, so I certainly will invite you to finish your testimony later, if you wish, and I'm sure there might be questions as well, so I do want to invite you back
okay.
At that time. So members, we're going to reconvene in room 10 at 5:30. And until then, this subcommittee stands in recess. Members, I'm going to reconvene our committee and bring House File 50 back up. That's where we left off. That's Representative Hornstein. Representative Hornstein, where we left off was there was still some testifying that was going on. I think the gentleman I had offered Mr. Halyer to finish his testimony, so perhaps, sir, if you can come forward and do that, and then we'll see if anyone else wants to testify, and then hopefully we'll take questions and then move to a vote. Welcome back, Mr. Halyer. Please restate your name for the record and give us finish your testimony, please. Thank you.
Thank you. My name is Brett Collier.
Collier.
From Big Lake.
Mr. Collier, how do you spell your last name?
C-O-L-L-I-E-R.
Yeah. Thank you.
First name Brett, B-R-E-T.
Thank you. Please proceed, Mr. Collier.
I believe where I left off was there is another bill in the House, House File 104, that wishes to increase the current $50 fine to at least $150 and then up to $500 for third offense, with the Senate version wanting to actually revoke your license for a period of time following the third offense. This is a sound and logical path that Minnesota should be taking. This is an increase in both the penalty and deterrent for the actions which are actually causing distracted driving deaths. But let me remind you, if both this hands-free bill and the increased fines bill were to pass this session, you are going to be charging people who are simply holding the phones to their ear a penalty of at least $150 and possibly revoking their license for performing an activity that, again, statistically is not a major contributor to distracted driving deaths here in Minnesota. What are the proponents not telling you? The proponents continue to tout that there are 13 of 14 states, although I guess the flyer that's in the back has a says 12 of 15 states now, in which, when they implemented a hands-free bill, have seen a drop in distracted driving deaths. What they fail to tell you is that in Vermont, for example, they instituted both a statewide ban on texting and driving at the same time they instituted a ban on hands-free. So you simply can't point at the hands-free ban as the sole reason for the drop in deaths. So what other facts are the supporters of this bill leaving out? It's been recently reported that the average number of distracted driving deaths from 2012 through 2017 in Minnesota was 53 per year. I got that out of the Star Tribune. Besides this being a drop from the 2015 number of 74 deaths, remember, when I'm talking 53 deaths, 74 deaths, we're talking about all types of distracted driving deaths, not just ones involving the use of a phone. Please don't let your emotions cloud your judgment. Please use your common sense and the data. Thank you. Any questions?
Thank you, Mr. Collier. Are there any questions for Mr. Collier? If not, then thank you, sir. Thank you for hanging around and finishing your testimony. I appreciate it.
No problem.
Is there anyone? I do know that Representative Miller has a question. He's on top of my list, but I want to make sure there are any other testifiers on this bill. Please come forward. Welcome to the committee. Our practice is to state your name for the record and then give us your testimony.
My name is Yarik Tikalski. Last name T-I-K-A-L-S-K-Y. So, as I just said, my name is Yarik Tikalski. I'm from New Prague, and I'm 16 years old, and I have had my license for a little under a year. Since my grandpa Joe was killed in 2015, my mom, who was texting your daughter, I, along with my family, have been working to make our roads safer. We've spoken at high school assemblies, to driver's ed classes, and testified at the state capitol. I'm very frustrated with how long it has taken the state of Minnesota to make a decision that 17 other states have made. My family has been testifying for almost 4 years now, some families for almost a decade. Every year we've come across a loophole or a new obstacle. Watching the hearing on TV today, we heard from representatives' concerns about racial profiling. I think it's unfair to stop someone because of their background. but if they are holding a phone while driving, they are breaking the law. I can't tell you if the driver who killed my grandpa is Irish, German, or Jewish, but I can tell you that grandpa won't be at my graduation next year. Distracted drivers do not discriminate. Every year, our messages have been the same. We provide you with facts and statistics, and we tell you our sad stories and show you our loved ones' faces. The only thing that does change is the number of Minnesotans that are killed due to distracted driving. The members in our club continue to grow. Now we are hearing some legislators think it would be okay to hold a phone for GPS uses, even though the phone tells you where to turn next. I'm 16 and I know two hands on the wheel is safer than one. Please don't give drivers another excuse to hold their phones. Please pass a clean, hands-free bill. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Tikowska, and please accept my condolences and our sorrow for your loss. I believe I speak on behalf of our entire committee, and I take it that's Grandpa Joe's picture there behind us.
It is. Thank you.
Thank you. I believe we're ready for questions, and Representative Hornstein and Chair Hornstein, and Representative Miller has a question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Chair Hornstein. I had a conversation with the chair. We kind of ran into each other in the hallway, and I just want to reiterate just a couple brief things that I said. On a bill that, as you're right, seems to be a lot simpler than we seem to be making it, but I think your bill is heading very strongly in the right direction. I also know that there's some other bills that are coming down. One of the things that I've realized is, in my opinion, we all agree that we don't want people that are distracted driving because they become, as we talked about drunk driving the other day, become a weapon, right? And a very terrible thing happens. So I'm very sorry for your loss and the losses of the others. The question that I have, it doesn't need to affect how your bill moves forward, but I don't know if, Mr. Chair, if there's other bills moving forward or as we move forward and discuss this. The other night or last night when we were talking about the exceptions in one of the bills we were talking about, we listed them, and there was that discussion about how when we start listing, we end up missing things when we start listing. And so when it comes to this, by far and away, things related to the cell phone are causing the most distracted driving problems. But that doesn't dismiss the fact that we have other forms of distracted driving. Some of them may be more serious than others. You know, maybe a cup isn't as serious for one person as it might be a hot cup of coffee for another, spilled on their lap or something like that. Is there a way, Mr. Chair, as we move forward, the one thing, and I totally get the issue related to phones. I get it because it's clear and present and it's a huge deal. But is there a way, perhaps, that we can empower law enforcement to make a determination that someone was distracted driving and have things associated with the fact that it was distracted driving and not necessarily just the tool by which they were being distracted by? I don't know if that makes sense to you of what I'm trying to say, but this will take, we have something that's not hands-free, and I'm not asking you to change this bill at all, but we're addressing one problem, but I can tell you the hot cup of coffee or that spills, or a dog on your lap, or some of these other things are kind of some legitimate things as well. And I just think, again, in context, I hate to be redundant on this, but just to be clear, you know, when we make a list of things, we miss things on the list. Is there a way that we can empower law enforcement? So I don't know if it's to you or to you, but if someone can kind of respond to that, that'd be helpful.
Mr. Chair, I can answer that.
Okay, hold on a second. Let's start with the author of the bill. And then I believe our lead, Johnson, has some thoughts, and I have some quick thoughts as well. Chair Hornstein.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Miller. That's a good question. I think there are there is a law that I think does cover all the things that you had mentioned. And there is some discretion for law enforcement if they see that kind of activity and they see, you know, drivers that are not, obeying basic traffic laws. But we did. I authored the texting bill in 2008, and this very issue came up on the House floor. And my response, Mr. Chairman, Representative Miller, is that I think the texting and cell phone use are sort of in a category among themselves. And I say that because they are proliferating at such a high rate that this is really the number one form of distraction on our roadways. And, you know, what we're doing with this bill is, I think, enhancing the exist. You know, this is really just adding on to that texting law in a sense. It is, as the gentleman who just testified pointed out, same penalties. We're not changing the penalties, et cetera. Maybe that's a separate conversation that we can have with Representative Detmer's bill. But I do believe the things that you were mentioning are covered currently.
Okay.
Thank you. And Representative Johnson, I think you have something you want to add to this as well.
Mr. Chair, as far as the accident reports go, the last time I saw an accident report, and it just had distracted driving. They would have to put a category on that form for cell phone use and texting. And if they did that, would I think it would be great. We'd actually get real good information, but it needs to be distinctive between cell phone use and texting or data use. That way it would get a true indication whether it's talking on the phone or actual texting or looking stuff up. But it could be done on the state accident report form, but that's something the state would have put into the system.
Very well. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That's an excellent suggestion. I appreciate that.
Very well. Are there any other questions? Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, you know, it's unfortunate that we've added what I deem as a rather controversial, I know it didn't mean to be controversial, but it is rather controversial piece that the previous testifier kind of referenced when we were talking about gender, talking about ethnicity and race, the study portion. And I would just ask, you know, I've kind of stated my piece about why it's controversial, the fact that we're using the word gender when that's not even on our driver's license. It's the word sex. Gender is not defined in statute. Sex is. Gender could mean a multiplicity of things. We had a committee hearing yesterday or the day before. Was that just yesterday, I think?
It was this morning.
That was this morning. Wow. Oh. That tells you how long we've been here.
I feel you.
Talking so much about gender and what that means and what it doesn't mean. My ask would be if we could change the word back to sex, which is actually what is on our driver's license, which is something that when a state trooper does pull up, I actually did a ride-along just a couple months ago now, with a state trooper, and they have all that data right there. It's right on your driver's license. It's something that can be easily pulled up. Gender's not. Gender is something you're going to have to ask the person, how do they identify? It's much more complicated. I have concerns about the race, ethnicity, and all of that as well in the study. And I understand you're trying to get at someone's perception. I feel like we're going backwards. I mean, you've got all this implicit bias training. The officers are trying to be neutral on everything, and now we're saying, no, now pay attention to it. So I just feel like we're going backwards, and I just ask that we can maybe consider that. And I realize that this bill has another stop, and it's coming back to judiciary, so we'll be talking about this again. But I just wanted to point that out, that this bill that we want to be so supportive of has now become controversial in my view.
Thank you, Representative O'Neill, and obviously the author of the bill is hearing the testimony, and will consider the comments of this committee if the bill proceeds. I must say, you know, as someone who moved the author of the bill, that there's nothing about this study that stops the bill from doing what it should do, which is to be real clear with the public, it seems to me, to be real clear that it will be a violation to use a cell phone while you're driving, and that that will be an actionable cause for being stopped and for having, you know, our justice system take the steps that we do when people violate the law. I see the author nodding his head. I don't think you would have accepted an amendment that would have gutted or weakened your attempt to make the public safe in this regard. But certainly you've heard the testimony here, Representative Hornstein. There's a better way to do things. You know, that is our duty as legislators as we move legislation forward. Are there any other questions? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I just want to, build on and reiterate what you were saying, Mr. Chair, that I really view the addition of that amendment as being a really helpful thing, that really strengthening already very strong bill. I just want to emphasize the point that and this is one of the reasons I really resisted the secondary amendment, is that there's nothing in here that affects the interaction between the trooper and the driver. This is really assessing these important points that have been made by the bill's author and by the chair about just the concern about there being disparities. And so in that way, I guess I'll disagree respectfully with Representative O'Neill that it seems to me that and concerns expressed by others as well. But what really matters is the perception by the trooper, by the officer, and simply having that information. And so in that way, I mean, was looking, Representative Neal, at the definitions of sex and gender and make those distinctions that in fact how what may be in the mind of the trooper is the information that is recorded. It's very explicit that there's not supposed to be any interaction based on a discussion or asking anything of the driver, which might impact the stop, but instead simply using their observation. So in any case, I think this is very strong. I don't view this as being problematic at all. In fact, I view it as being very helpful. And I'm so grateful to you, Representative Hornstein, for the bill, and certainly for the families who've been pushing this. And boy, I sure hope that this is the year that this can become law. So thank you.
Very well. Thank you, Representative Pintel. Any other questions or comments? Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, this is a bill that I know is going to pass. Well, overall, part of it I support. We've heard some very emotional testimony. But the tough part is we have to overlook the emotion. We have to legislate on facts, because when you go by emotions, we usually get it wrong. I do have some concerns on this, and anybody's asked me, I've always told people, I don't want to disenfranchise the low income and even the middle income. I don't know if you know it, but I looked it up today. The average age of a car in Minnesota is 12 years old. Bluetooth and sync and all that technology didn't start even being installed in cars at a 50% ratio till about 2014. In 2016, only 86% of the cars made were even installed. I recently purchased a car in 2008. I've tried three different items to try to get that one touch in my car. I can get down to three touches when I'm down here in the Minneapolis, St. Paul area. I get out of the metro area, it doesn't work very well. And if I don't tap in a 3 LTE area, my Siri on my phone doesn't even work at all. And you get outside the greater metro area, we have a lot of areas that do not have LTE. So Siri will not work to make your phone call for you. So I struggle with this because I'm trying to find a way to get this to work and work throughout the state of Minnesota. So those who aren't who can't afford a car that's less than 3 years old, 3 to 4 years old, that has this technology. Yes, can I get it for my $3,000 beater? Yeah, but once I figured out the cost, it's $1,000 to get it installed in my car. So it makes me struggle. Are we setting this up to be a huge disadvantage to the low-income people in the state that cannot afford a car that has this capability, forcing them to break the law that we pass? Now, Representative Considine has a bill coming up that was pretty much similar to what I had in the omnibus bill last year. And I think that's a good bill, a good way to go. Listening to the testimony, it's very heartbreaking. And last year, listening to all of it, the biggest thing at the end of everybody's testimony was the lack of penalty for the person who was driving distracted. They were getting just a ticket. They weren't even getting jail time. And the bill that Representative Considine has solves that issue. Yes, is hands-free coming? Absolutely. But we have to make sure when we do that we don't disenfranchise people.
Thank you, Representative Johnson. You and I have had a short conversation about this in passing in the hallway, and I actually share some of your concerns in this regard. And absolutely, like you, not leaning any harm or or ill will or spite to, you know, the victims and their families and their beloved lost ones. It is the nature of lawmaking, right, that we often have to wrestle with all sorts of different outcomes of our laws and how they're applied, you know, et cetera. Quite frankly, it's part of the reason why I really did want to push this data provision so that we understood, you know, what is going on in terms of the broader society's understanding of who's driving. It doesn't quite get at the issue that you've raised, which I think is a righteous issue. I will support this bill, and as you indicated, I suspect, if not all, most of us will, and this probably will be successful, but I think it is important to raise, you know, those areas of concern. I can certainly allow, you know, the author of the bill to comment, but it looks like you also want to add something to that.
I also want to add, I had another group contacted me because of the way the definition is in the bill. Finally, I got in front of me, but for it's a two-way communication device. Some industries have gotten touch with me between taxi cabs. Some of our cities have talked about it with the two-way radios in the vehicles. They use a radio. It's a handheld communication device. Instead of having mounted radios in the car, they've gone to handheld radio, portable radios. They're concerned, and along with the ham radio industry, because they're not securely or affixed to the vehicle because they're handheld, so they can take them with them. They're going to be affected by this bill as well, and it's the school bus operators, it's the taxi cab drivers, it's the garbage delivery people with the radios in their cars that it could affect it, and that's what their concern is. I just want to make sure it's not intended to do that.
Okay, Chair Hornstein.
Well, thank you. I mean, I guess I would respond to several of the comments made, maybe all at once here in a package. First of all, I think that Representative O'Neill and Representative Johnson bring up valid concerns. And, you know, I just wanted to say, at least, you know, in terms of the research I did after the chair and others, not just the chair, have expressed some issues around profiling. I, you know, checked with the National Conference of State Legislators and others, and I learned quite a bit over these last few weeks. One is that the state of North Carolina has, on a bipartisan basis, authorized, actually many years ago, the same kind of study that we're talking about today, actually even far more exhaustive, and they got lots of really important data out of that. So this is not unprecedented. I also learned that Minneapolis and St. Paul are doing this kind of data collection, and it has gone well, and it's been very valuable, and it's been very transparent. And so this is just, you know, a very small study with one department measuring, you know, some data on one particular infraction. So, you know, I feel it's important. Again, I've heard it in among my constituents. We're having a very robust conversation in the city of Minneapolis right now about traffic stops, and this is something that I think the police and the community are engaged in a very constructive way. So you thanked me, Mr. Chair. I want to thank you for raising this, and again, I've learned a lot over these last few weeks about it, and I think we came up with something that I think can address this concern and start a conversation. It's important to have this conversation here at the state level. So, I think gender and sex, maybe we, you know, I'm willing to take a look at that. You know, the North Carolina bill that I somewhat modeled this off of did have that, so, you know, that's why it's here, but we can have a conversation again with the St. Paul and Minneapolis departments that are doing this kind of data collection and see if they include that, and if so, how they use it. So I'm willing to follow up on that. And I think, again, and Representative Johnson, you raise a very valid concern about issues with people that may not be able to afford some of the technology. I know that, you know, we're still talking about something that maybe can affix the phone to the dashboard like the Lyft and Uber drivers have. There are some cheap, relatively inexpensive alternatives as well. But it's a valid concern, but I don't necessarily know. I hadn't heard that I don't think it would cost $1,000 necessarily to convert a car. But it's a valid concern, and you know, there are alternatives, and I think we need to look at those. And to the last point you made, Representative Johnson, I think that, you know, I don't think this necessarily covers, and I we have some experts here in the room, they could comment, then I want to answer your question. I don't think that we're really looking at that sort of ham radio operation, but I do want to introduce to the committee very quickly and briefly, Mr. Chair, because I know you have other business. Paul Austin from the Minnesota Safety Council, his organization is one of the oldest and established groups in the state that works on traffic safety, and he's been very helpful in the development of this bill, and I think can answer your question, Representative Johnson, better than I can. So, Mr. Chair, if Mr. Austin could answer that, I would appreciate that.
Please. Thank you. Welcome to the committee, Mr. Austin.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Paul Austin, A-A-S-E-N. I'm the president of the Minnesota Safety Council. Mr. Chair, Representative, our understanding is that the smartphone penetration in the market is now about 85%. And so that means that, 85 out of 100 cell users are, in fact, holding a device that can connect to other devices much more readily, so that helps with the concern you raise. I drive a 2012 car. My phone connects to my car. I used to drive a 2007 vehicle. It had a rudimentary early kind of Bluetooth connection that did not work with a contemporary phone, but it had a headphone jack. And so I went to the dollar store and spent $2 on a cable and connected my phone from the headphone jack directly to the dash and was able to use it that way. So there are alternatives. They aren't absolutely across the board. It's not, not every single phone. My mom carries a flip phone. She's 89 years old. That's not going to connect to her car. Mom is also not going to be texting while she's driving, thankfully. And that's the big underpinning to this whole issue is if you feel a need, if you must use your phone while you drive, and I can't underline the if you must, then please use it hands-free. Don't have it in your hand. That's really the goal of the bill in total. The radio issue, this section of law does not affect radio use. If you look at some other states' legislations, they have very complicated hands-free bills that include all kinds of radio systems. This one does not change the radio system regulation in the state. You do potentially have the issue of somebody being mistaken for having a device in their hand, but I think we run that risk with a sandwich or a hamburger as well on some level. So it's not absolutely perfect, but it does not directly affect how those are used.
And Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, I just want to make sure that the intent was placed in the record, so we have that if it should arise.
Very well. Thank you, Mr. Olson. Any other questions? Chair Hornstein, if this motion is successful, your bill will move then to the Judiciary Committee. That offers you yet
Correct.
Another opportunity
Yep.
to address any of the issues that have been raised here if they need to be addressed.
Yep.
And a number of us do serve on the Chairman Lesch's committee. So with that, I offer you the last words, and
well,
I'll take the vote.
Mr. Chair, members, thank you. I always learn a lot at these hearings, and it's helpful to have the different stops, and we can make a good bill better, and I think we've done that today, and certainly there's some outstanding issues that should be addressed, and I will look at that very closely. And so I just wanted to thank the committee for hearing the bill and for your, the excellent discussion and the questions that we've had, and I ask for your support.
Terrific. I'm going to wait a few seconds while a couple of our colleagues come down because we're about to vote. Who made the motion? Do you recall? I'm trying to recall who made the motion.
Mr. Chair.
Who's that here?
Okay. Mr. Chair.
Representative Lucero.
Do I have an opportunity to ask a few questions?
Representative Lucero, we're about to vote. Good time to have asked those questions.
So I made it by the hair of my chin.
Would have been good if you had been here earlier when we had a lengthier conversation. I will I'll be malleable and give you about a minute to do so.
I appreciate that. I won't ask any questions, just some comments. And I appreciate the indulgence. Several of us are actually sitting up in another committee right now. We're at a bill hearing. So
you're correct, Representative.
So I just want to go back to the prior conversation that took place earlier where we had the commissioner making some comments in regards to law enforcement. And as one who has a law enforcement degree, having gone to school, having gone through skills, and was licensed by gone through the post test, absolutely agree with the commissioner's comments that law enforcement professionals have a high degree of training to see and perform their work without regard to race, ethnicity, et cetera. And the part that's alarming to me is, in fact, his comment was law enforcement professionals do not act on race and ethnicity in making the determination to pull somebody over, for example. What
is concerning to me is regarding the amendment that was adopted is it does the opposite. It takes those law enforcement professionals who have years of training to not view scenarios and situations with those lens on, and now is specifically directing them to do just the opposite, to view the scenario with the lens of race and ethnicity. And I think that creates a dichotomy that we just need to be concerned about with the bill in its present form. Then the next thing I would just draw attention in, regarding the bill language, it's on line 1.17 and 1.12 that speaks about the beginning and end of this temporary data gathering. So it begins in August and ends at the end of the year. So that is a five-month period. And so it's a very small window. And as we know, with the climate here in Minnesota, the different seasons, things can be different. And so we have to be of the understanding that the data collection that's going to take place is only 5 months of 1 year. Second, per the prior conversation, it's the state patrol that's going to perform this. And that's on line 1.19 to 1.10. And the state patrol is overseeing certain highways and interstates in Minnesota. Now, can they go to other areas? Absolutely can. But their primary focus is not going to be local residential roads, municipalities, et cetera. And so we also have to be cognizant that the data gathering that's going to take place is going to be skewed to one portion or segment of Minnesota rather than cities, local municipalities, et cetera, et cetera. So I think the data that would be collected certainly isn't going to be scientific in the data set. And then second, it's going to be based on perception. And then the conversations that I heard here, and unfortunately I disagree with the commissioner when he said, we would then take those the information gathered from a subset of information based on perception and then began to look at that, how we can enact policy. So now we are going to be basing policy on this, in my opinion, flawed information, flawed data. And I have a lot of heartburn over the bill in its present form. So I thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Representative Lucero. We did talk about these points earlier, except for the seasonal one, and you might be singing after my heart because I certainly would like a longer period of time, quite frankly, to do this study appropriately, and that might be an issue for us in judiciary if this bill moves through. I do want to say for the record, members, you know, and we heard from the commissioner earlier, and of course he's not here to repeat it. The whole point of, one, that profiling is, in fact, an issue in our society. Two, that law enforcement takes it very seriously, and they work consistently to address it. And that, three, one of the tools that they use in order to address it is to, like they did in North Carolina and they're doing in St. Paul and Minneapolis, is to do these kind of studies. And perception absolutely goes to the heart of the study. It isn't for any other purpose than to be able to properly help our law enforcement to be good professionals. Representative Lucero, we're about to vote. If you feel very strongly about it, we can certainly do a roll call vote if that's your choice. All right, very well. If not, then the chair, since Representative Dean is not here, moves that House File 50, as amended, be referred to the Committee on Judiciary. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign.
No.
Motion prevails. Representative Horsing, thank you so
thank
much
you, Mr.
for working
Chair.
Awfully
thank
hard
you,
to
members.
Bring this important bill before us. And I do want to thank the families that have been with us throughout the day as well.
Thank you so much, Mr. Chair and members.
Very well. Should we do Shelley or John?
Probably Shelley. She hasn't.
Yeah, where am I? All right, Representative Christensen, why don't we do you because you have a testifier, I believe. Representative Christensen moves that House File 1149 be laid over for possible inclusion in our committee's omnibus bill. Representative Christensen, your bill is before us.
Yeah. That's very good.
This is for you. Thank you.
Okay, thank you, Chair Mariani. Thank you, members, for listening. Under current law, conservation officers can make DWI arrests if individuals are hunting while under the influence or operating an off-road vehicle or motorboat. This bill will give them the same authority as other peace officers under the DWI chapter. Currently, if an individual drives a motor vehicle while under the influence, for example, in a boat landing in a park area, that officer, the conservation officer, has to call in another officer from another agency to make an investigation and an arrest. Needless to say, this can cause time delays that prevent the conservation officer from performing his or her duties. Conservation officers are fully trained, and this is important, they are fully trained to investigate and arrest DWI, so there would be no new training involved. The DWI Task Force supports this bill, and I have six letters of support from the Minnesota State Patrol Troopers Association, the Minnesota State Patrol, Minnesota Sheriff's Association, the Chiefs of Police, Minnesota Conservation Officers Association, and my own Washington County Sheriff, Dan Starry. The bill has broad bipartisan support in the Senate and has moved on, so I ask you please to support HF 1149. And I'm here to ask questions. Would you like to hear from the testifier first, Chair?
Representative Grissom, I think that would be appropriate.
Okay, so I'd like to introduce Colonel Rodman Smith.
Colonel Smith, welcome back to the committee. Thank you for hanging out with us all day, Colonel.
For the record, Colonel Rodman Smith, Director of Enforcement for the Department of Natural Resources. Mr. Chair, members, I'd like to thank Representative Christensen for bringing this forward. This is a change in a definition of peace officer in Chapter 169. Many different parts of statute have many different definitions of peace officers. And so under this change, as Representative Christensen said, the current language says that conservation officers can write impaired driving for motorboats, recreational vehicles, and hunting while intoxicated. Last year, as we heard earlier from Representative New in this committee, we made a giant leap forward here in the state of Minnesota by closing the gap between recreational DWIs and traditional motor vehicle DWIs. And this is one more piece that will help close that gap. So conservation officers are trained in all the field sobriety testing that's needed to be done, so there is no cost. In fact, in the long run, this will be a cost savings, as Representative Christensen said. You know, if a conservation officer sees somebody pulling a boat and they're drunk in a public access, if they launch the boat, we can arrest them. But if they're still in the parking lot in their truck, our officer is going to have to call a deputy, a trooper, or a local police officer. They're going to have to come out. They're going to write the DWI. And then when it goes to court, the conservation officer is going to have to go to court to testify on the probable cause. And then the deputy, trooper, or peace officer is going to have to come and testify on the testing. So this is just a common sense. We feel a common sense change that'll make our roads, waterways, and trails much safer in the state. Thank you for your support.
Thank you, Colonel. Representative Christensen.
Okay, and Colonel Matt Langer.
Welcome to the committee, Colonel Langer, and thank you for also being with us for a number of hours today.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, on behalf of the Department of Public Safety and the Minnesota State Patrol, we are here to testify in support of this bill for all the things that I almost heard Colonel Smith say as I was distracted talking about the previous bill. But we think this is good for Minnesota. It's good for traffic safety. It's good for recreational safety. It's much more efficient. And no officer, deputy, or trooper enjoys going over and helping the conservation officer do what they're capable of doing, but the law prohibits. So we see this as a good thing for Minnesota and no downside.
Thank you, Kurt. I have a quick question. How often does this arise? Is it a regular? Is it a rare instance in your experience at any rate?
Mr. Chair, it's a good question. It's fairly rare, actually. So it's not that we're burdened to help the DNR. It just makes perfect sense. One of the scenarios I give is if an impaired driver is backing their boat into a lake to go fishing, and they back into the dock, and they're in their truck, and the conservation officer is there, the conservation officer is prohibited from arresting that driver for impaired driving. But if they get their boat in the water and hit the dock, they can take full action and arrest that impaired driver behind the wheel of their boat. And that's one of the examples that we give, as it just doesn't make a lot of sense. It's been this way for a long time, but we're happy to help the DNR anytime we can, but it just makes good sense that they can take it from start to finish.
And it seems to me, obviously, that the best outcome for public safety is that that harm doesn't happen in the first place. I think we do have a question. Representative Bowler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I think it's a great bill, and just wanted to kind of piggyback off of something that was said about the current inefficiencies and needing the two officers then to go to court, and that could be going to court twice, right, because you would have the implied consent proceeding perhaps, and then also the criminal case moving as well. So just wanted to highlight that there's an added inefficiency there.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moore, you're exactly correct. It's not just at the time of the arrest. It's the downstream effect of having whoever helped the DNR do make that arrest is in court at the same time. So it's exactly right.
Very well. Representative Lesh, Chair Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was actually looking forward to coming to this hearing and finding out about this, but I'm surprised no one's asked this yet. This was an express parens put in this subdivision to specifically exclude state conservation officers at some point. So someone did it for a reason at some point, and I'm wondering who that is, and we're all, you know, breaking bread, singing kumbaya now. Yeah, good idea to change it, but I'm wondering, someone somewhere knows why it was put in the first place. So why was that?
I don't know. Colonel Smith.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lesh, it happened before my time, but from what I've been told, it was a couple-fold. One was a funding issue, and at the time, conservation officers were almost entirely funded through the Game and Fish Fund and Natural Resource Fund. Since then, we do get general fund dollars. And so if an arrest in this case, if there's an arrest for DWI in a traditional motor vehicle, that time and all those expenses for that officer would be coded to general fund time. Another reason was impaired driving and society's understanding and our training, to be quite frank, has evolved over time. And so the conservation officer corps of 20, 30 years ago, and the training that they had back then has changed dramatically. As society has changed and our responsibility has changed, we do have the current peace officer powers as just about every other peace officer, except in this case. In rural Minnesota, if we're out working deer shiners and there's a domestic call at 2 o'clock in the morning and there's one deputy on, our conservation officer will go over and help that deputy so that they're not going to domestic all by themselves. So a long answer to your question is twofold. I think it was, from my understanding and from what I've been told, it was a funding issue. And then the other thing, part was we were going to do Game and Fish. We didn't really have the training at the time, and things have evolved over time when it comes to impaired driving.
It's a good question, actually. It's good to be able to have a perspective on the history of it. Thank you. Chair Lesh.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. I appreciate the answer, but, you know, it's mostly hearsay. I'm wondering if any of our researchers can tell us the year that this was included, and I don't know. I mean, I'm assuming it'd take a little looking into. This smells to me, Mr. Chair, like some chair in some committee had a very specific reason why it was excluded at some point. That's what it smells like. And because I don't get the sense, you know, despite what the good conservation officer said, that it was just kind of, well, you know, a funding issue. It looks to me like that was in there for a very specific reason. It might have been a grudge by some member of chair or something, but there's a story behind it. I just want to know the story, that's all. It's probably a good story.
I'm going to ask our legal counsel to tell us a good story. And I'll give you a second. I can tell you that this bill came to me via Senator Clausen in the Senate, and just, you know, a little tidbit of info of where the bill came. But Mr. Johnson.
Well, I mean, Mr. Chair, just to clarify, what I meant is from chair once upon a time, like some chair like 20 years ago, well, whatever was what I meant. So.
No doubt. Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members, I'm afraid I can't shed a whole lot of light on this. In 2000, this was adopted. In the year 2000, the definition referred to another section under 169.07, and the definition there. That in the last 3 minutes is as far as I've been able to change. If you give me a little bit more time, I might be able to provide a little additional information.
Mr. Johnson, the committee wants to hear a good story, so we'll probably come back at some point. Representative O'Neill.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. So it's similar to actually what Representative Chair Lesh actually was concerned about. And so sometimes we do things and we don't always know the history. We don't know why it is the way it is in statute. And something that I just wanted to raise because I was the chief author of a bill about 3 years ago now that changed the HRO statutes. And so the harassment restraining order so that all, in fact, I think the lobbyist is still in the room that worked with me on that bill. Let's see if she's going to pay attention. We're all looking at you. Anyway, so we changed it to say just peace officers as opposed to just the sheriff's department. So I think with this change, what we've done now is we're now allowing the conservation officers to serve an HRO. And I'm not sure that that's, maybe we want to do that. I don't know, but maybe we should at least talk about that if that's something that they would like to also be included in the list. Because now that they're included in the list of peace officers without any condition, now they're included in being able to serve an HRO. Now, I don't know if they can actually see the database that will be created because I don't know what database they use, which might be another situation. But just something that we probably should think about as we change this part of statute and decide other things, and that would be one thing.
It's actually fascinating, Representative O'Neill. Now you have my, you've piqued my interest. I don't know if Colonel Smith wishes to offer, you know, at least a preliminary thought in this regard. Oh, okay.
Mr. Chair, Representative O'Neill, as I said earlier in my opening comments, there's a bunch of different places in statute where peace officer is defined. So this is changing the definition of peace officer in 169A, which is mostly traffic related.
Representative Mueller, I think you might have some insight on this question.
That was what I was going to say, too. I pulled up 169A, and it's limited to these kinds of cases for peace officer here.
Very helpful. Representative Sura, on this point?
Yeah, exactly, at this point. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So, and that also then brings up the question in my mind. As I'm reading the bill summary and as we heard described here, we've been focusing the conversation on DWIs, but this actually, the change, actually does way more than just this. It'll allow for anything as defined in the chapter that was just referenced in terms of enforcement, well beyond the scope of DWI. And I guess the bill summary, and I didn't research what the full scope of that is, I think that this committee would want to know what this change is actually going to do in terms of enforcement. Before we move forward, I'm just throwing that out there for the chair to consider.
Great questions, Representative Lucero. Mr. Johnson, can you help us?
Mr. Chair, members, this is limited to Chapter 169A, and 169A is the driving while impaired chapter. So this would not apply to other moving violations or any other criminal penalties. It would only apply to violations under 169A, which are DWI violations.
Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Chair Mariani, Mr. Johnson did just to explain one thing I was going to say is that this is just the DWI statutes. 169A in 2000 was created, moved out of the 169 statutes. And I'm trying to remember back when I started my law enforcement career back in 85. Back then, DNR could not do traffic enforcement, and they were licensed peace officers. So it probably goes back into even before we actually required licensing and post-certification become an officer, where DNR was trained to do just game-related stuff and DNR-related stuff, and the troopers and peace officers did the traffic.
Very well. Representative Grassl.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Boy, did you guys dodge a bullet on that one, huh? You could have been doing civil. You could have been doing all kinds of different things. But from what I know about game wardens' equipment, having served as a deputy sheriff, you guys usually don't have cages in your vehicles for transport. So how have you handled that all along? You'd have to hook up with a trooper or a deputy sheriff regardless.
Mr. Chair, Representative, there's an exemption in statute for conservation officers to transport prisoners without a cage, and that's existing law. And so we do transport prisoners in our pickup trucks. If they are squirrely, unruly, then we will call for somebody to transport for us. But, you know, 99% of the time when we do transport somebody, they're cooperative, and we do have that exemption in law where we don't need the cage.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, because that was kind of my question. Are we going to need to start putting new equipment into the vehicles and such? But thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Grassl, for looking out for our target amount as well. So, are there any other questions? All right. Well, thank you, Colonel Smith, and also Colonel Langer. Representative Christensen, we're going to lay House File 1149 over for possible inclusion. You might want to check into that story because I suspect we're going to want that story.
Okay.
And hopefully it'll be a juicy one when we bring this back. So with that, we'll lay House File 11. The chair lays this over for possible inclusion in our omnibus.
Thank you.
Our last bill. Thank you, Representative Christensen. Our last bill then. Yes. Representative Chair Considine, House File 1375. Chair Considine, I believe your motion is to re-refer House File 1375 to the Transportation Committee. Your bill is before us.
You are correct, Mr. Chair.
And we have co-presenters. Representative
co-presenter, yes.
Central.
Reluctantly.
Good.
I'm up here as assistant counsel or something like that. I'm not quite sure, but in any case, here I sit. But
he just keeps kicking me underneath the table.
That's right. That'll be my job.
Somebody get a picture. Thank you.
It's fine. Yeah. No publicity is bad publicity, right?
The bill.
Right. It's actually a serious subject.
Yeah, it is. For those of you that don't know, a month before I was elected, my brother was in Brainerd returning his boat. Guy blew through a stop sign, killed him. My brother was a retired Air Force officer who spent his entire adult life protecting the country. He had finally retired, moved back to Minnesota. He'd been back about a year. When I went up for the hearing, the guy that killed him pulled into the parking lot ahead of me. They hadn't taken his driver's license. I got to court. They charged him with a misdemeanor, even though he had blown through a stop sign to do so. And honestly, this bill still would not do anything about that. I spoke. The judge departed upwards and gave him 30 days of house arrest. As someone who has had personally somebody killed, that wasn't enough. And this bill says that if you are driving the car in a reckless manner, or you are driving under, and there's a list of, once again, suspensions, reasons for suspensions. That's why I was so grateful for Representative Lesch's bill, because it took out some that I don't think we wanted to include. But if you have a history of, you of driving after suspension or in a negligent manner, that the county attorney should at least be able to go for a gross misdemeanor. The maximum for that is a year and a $10,000 fine. I just don't think that's really terribly high for somebody that kills somebody. I guess I don't really have a lot more to add than that. Stand for questions.
Thank you, Representative. Representative Pinto, perhaps you can add some more, particularly on some of the technical points of the language before us.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I had, so as folks know, I have previously focused a lot on gender violence on prosecution in my work outside the legislature, but for the past couple of years I've been handling charging of cases across a really wide spectrum, and so they include criminal vehicular operation and homicide. And in general, there's a standard that if there's not alcohol involved and other issues, that there's this series, and you can see this is really pretty much all in the bill of 609.2112 is the statute, and there's this series of levels of harm that's caused, everything from bodily harm, which is pretty minor, all the way up to death. And if there's not alcohol involved, then the question is whether the driver has been grossly negligent. And that's a very high standard. It's very tough to prove that somebody's grossly negligent. I see Representative Moeller nodding. And it has seemed to me that there are some circumstances where even when a driver is merely negligent, we still just at a moral gut levels believe that somebody should have a responsibility. I mean, it may well be that we say that mere negligence without anything else is something that we wouldn't want to change the law. And I will say that I suspect that every one of us at some point in our driving on a pretty regular basis is probably negligent at some point. That's a relatively lower standard. We shouldn't be, and perhaps none of you are, but it's a significantly lower standard than gross negligence. And so I've long thought that it would make sense that for certain circumstances beyond being under the influence of alcohol, it makes sense that if you're negligent plus one of those circumstances, that you should have the same accountability as if you're driving grossly negligent. This actually connects with distracted driving as being an example. I believe that we have this in here. But then also certain circumstances where someone is not being permitted to drive in the first place, that they don't have a valid driver's license. So this was the structure here, and the purpose of this was to set up those series of circumstances where someone can be held liable even if they're not grossly negligent in their driving, if they are merely negligent plus some other circumstance being present. And so that's the legal structure of the bill that I worked on with Representative Considine. And so I think now together we will presumably stand for questions.
Very well. Other questions for Representative Pinto and Representative Considine? Representative O'Neill.
So I'm sorry, I don't have the statutory reference, but it equates to juvenile traffic offender. And I don't have the statutory reference, but all of the listings in my brief seem reasonable. That one was just kind of curious. Juvenile traffic offenders, what I have here, and maybe my researcher can tell me what's the statutory reference for that. I want to go see if I can get it.
Is that one of them?
260B.
Oh. Being a juvenile, 260B.225.
Just when you find it, if you could maybe give the reasoning behind that and what that entails.
So this is maybe it's in the list in the bill brief, I think, 260. Oh, I should, Mr. Chair, with your permission.
I'm giving our researcher a minute to.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Look for that. Please, Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, members, the reference is to Section 260B.225, Subdivision 9, and that's a juvenile major highway or water traffic offender. So a juvenile court must find that a child is a juvenile major highway or water traffic offender, and they do that if they make any of the following dispositions with a case, which includes reprimanding a child, continuing a case for a reasonable period, requiring a child to attend a driver improvement school, recommending the Department of Public Safety suspends the license. If there are two or more of those violations, there are increased penalties in that section.
Mr.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe one way to think about this is that rather than simply saying that any time somebody's license has been suspended, revoked, canceled, or denied, that this would apply, that instead the scheme here was to pick out certain of those circumstances. There is some concern that we want to be focusing on situations where we've got concerns about the person's driving. So in this particular example, in order to be, as I look at that statute, in order to be a juvenile highway traffic offender, the child has to have committed a major traffic offense, which is defined in another section. And so the thought, if the person has committed a major traffic offense and has a license that's been suspended, revoked, canceled, et cetera, because of that purpose, then we say, okay, now they've shown themselves to be dangerous enough that then if they're driving and they're driving negligently and they cause the kind of harm that's listed in the bill or listed in the statute, then we believe that they should have liability for that injury that they've caused. So for that particular one, I think that's what's related there.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That helps explain what was the thought process behind that. A lot of statutory references in this, and so I'm just trying to wade my way through it.
Thank you for helping us vet through it. Representative Long.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Just a question for Representative Pinto. Thinking about the new negligence standard, what are some examples that you can think of where there would be a vehicular homicide, but it would not meet a negligence standard?
So, and it may, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Long, and I may look a little bit to Representative Mulward for assistance on this. Gross negligence, again, you have to be pretty out of it. I mean, so you have to be, you know, like blowing through a stop sign at a very high rate of speed. That would be grossly negligent, right? Driving through, potentially driving through a red light, but not at a really high rate of speed, might be merely negligent and not grossly negligent. I may, with the chair's permission, actually turn to see if Representative Mueller has any examples or help that she can provide, because she nodded vigorously before, so I may need to, pull her in on the basis of that nod, Mr. Chair, if she's willing.
Representative Mueller.
It has been a while, Mr. Chair, it has been a while since I've looked at some of those cases, but what you're talking about is what I sort of remember. It's almost like two things. It's almost like two steps of negligent, running a stop sign and going very fast.
Right.
It's like multiple things have to happen, and the courts have been really hesitant to find gross negligence if there's just kind of one factor. And
Chair Considine.
Thank you. When I started looking into this, I actually talked to a number of county attorneys, and every one of them had a story about somebody getting killed that they felt the only thing they could charge was a misdemeanor. Blue Earth County was a six-year-old child in Madison Lake, and, of course, those people were furious. Proving that gross negligence just has turned out to be a tremendously high bar, and most of them don't even try to do so.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So that's helpful. I think I understand the negligence versus gross negligence distinction. The question I'm trying to get at is, for the negligence standard, are there instances where you can think of where there would be a vehicular homicide, but it wouldn't rise to the negligence standard? Or is this essentially self-proving that all vehicular homicides are going to meet the negligence standard?
Chair Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Representative Long, so negligence is itself a standard, right? So there is something that would have to be pointed to in the driving that would say the person is driving negligently. So you could certainly imagine driving in a manner or such that you could cause somebody to be injured or even killed in a way where you are not driving negligently. So I can think actually of an example of a case where there was a case that I have to think about how many details I can provide on this, but a case where there was a gentleman who was late at night. He was dressed with dark clothing. He was wandering in the middle of a roadway was marked at a very high speed, and there was somebody who drove and who struck and who killed him. It seemed likely that this man was trying to be hit and struck and killed. And in that circumstance, it was no doubt that the driver's driving was what killed the victim, but there appeared to be no negligence on the part of the driver, so that would not be chargeable as criminal vehicular homicide. If there is negligence alone and there's nothing else, then I still think we have a moral sense that it may well be civil liability, but do we want to rise to the level of criminal? Perhaps not. But when there's something else involved, we would say that would be the case. So no, I can think of many circumstances where there would not be negligence, and yet there could be an injury or death. It would not be chargeable under the statute. I hope that helps your question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Long. Very well. Chairman Lesh.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Considine or Pinto. Is it your understanding that violating a statutory prohibition, even in the traffic code under 169 or something, would be categorized as negligence per se? You have a duty, and you breach it by breaking a traffic law.
Mr. Chair, so Representative Lesh, I would say no. I mean, if you're pointing to one of these references in the bill and what would be the statute, where it says in a negligent manner while something else is present, then I would think that'd be a pretty good argument that you could not be found per se negligent by doing the second thing, because the statute itself is describing them separately. I wouldn't read it that way, and I guess I wouldn't think a court would, but I'd be interested in your thoughts.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pinto, I asked a question. But I guess I'm just wondering, because you use that example of someone, you know, walking with a dark sweater on in a dark place or something. The cops that I know, you know, prosecuting traffic crimes for 15 years, in many cases, will write a ticket if there's any kind of collision, because as far as they're concerned, someone's at fault. And the default statute they were writing under doesn't fall under here, but it's duty to drive with due care. So that's why I asked, because some people think that if you hit something, you were going too fast for conditions, or failed to drive with due care, or something, and that could, in my opinion, be negligence per se, because, you know, depends on your perspective, of course. But that's why I was just wondering. Now, it's not in your list, but I am a person who, in my 15 years of prosecution, I had 4 of these cases where there was a petty misdemeanor violation and somebody died. The one that I remember last is a person driving west on Maryland right there, taking a left onto Western in my district and striking a kid. And it was charged as, you know, a petty misdemeanor, and the family was distraught. Now, they sued for wrongful death that way and everything, but it's a really tough thing to see and go through. And Representative Considine, I think a bill was brought up that year as well, and then and then 5 years before that, it keeps coming back. So the reason I just asked, though, is some of these cases are just really difficult, but that's all. Nothing more, Mr. Chair.
Indeed. Chairman Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Lesh, I'm thinking more about your question. I mean, it occurs to me we should have many examples of this, because right now, driving in a negligent manner while under the influence of alcohol, et cetera, you know, there are cases that are charged under that, right? And I'm pretty certain, I don't know if Representative Mueller something about this, but I'm pretty certain that in those cases, something does need to be pointed to beyond the, I don't mean to keep bringing you in, sorry. Something does need to be pointed to beyond the alcohol, or even something, you know, driving without due care. I mean, you know, if you're driving with the rest of traffic at 57 miles per hour on a 55 mile per hour highway, I would suspect, I haven't looked at this, but I suspect under case law, like, that would not qualify as negligent, even though you're violating the speed limit. But, I mean, so there does need to be something pointed to about not driving, but driving in some way where you're actually violating your duty of care. I would think that there would be information on that in the case law. I don't have that with me. But there obviously has been a lot of case law on it, because we've got lots of other examples of not just gross negligence, but negligence plus something else. We're just adding a bunch more something else's to the list.
Well, Mr. Chair, not to get into a nuanced academic argument about it, but when I say negligence per se, I'm not talking about the other elements of negligence. You know, you've got duty, breach, causation, damages. So I'm not going into the causation component. That's an entirely separate, arguable piece. But if someone could tell me I'm wrong, that that's not negligent, I think I'm right. I think that is negligence per se. If you break a law that's prescribed, that is a duty. If you are driving 57 and 55, you have a duty to not breach, to not go past that. And then the breach component is that you did drive 57, you breached it, so that is negligence per se. That doesn't mean you're going to be able to collect that or anything. It's just the prima facie case component of it. Someone tell me I'm wrong.
Chairman Pitfall, we're going to engage counsel here. They may have some thoughts.
Can I just quickly comment on
Chairman Counsel here.
Chairman Lesh, that was my initial. What you're saying is where I wanted to go. if you break the law and you kill somebody, that was what I started off with. And frankly, Mr. Johnson gave me a couple of examples that I didn't think were fair, so I backed off of that. And to be quite honest with you, I don't believe in my brother's case that it would be covered under this. I think they would still say this man, 89-year-old man, ran a stop sign and killed your brother. We're going to charge him with a misdemeanor. But frankly, Mr. Johnson gave me a couple of examples that I thought were didn't work for me. So that's why I backed off all law-breaking because, I won't go into that, but I thought he did a nice job on that.
Thank you, Chairman Constantine. Mr. Johnson?
Mr. Chair, members, I think I'm answering the question of negligence per se. It's a civil standard, as you know, right. Representative Lesh. And for negligence per se to attach, my understanding in the civil world is that the statute must be not only apply specifically to the situation, but that statute must have been designed to protect the person who was harmed in that particular situation. So if you have a situation where violating a traffic law was designed to protect the individual who was particularly harmed, negligence per se could apply. If you do not have that full situation, then negligence per se would not apply. That does not mean that it would not still be negligent. For example, driving 5 miles over the speed limit could still be negligent, but you might have to prove that that was not meeting the standard of reasonable care to reach that level of negligence, not simply rely on the violation of law as you would in a negligence per se case.
Okay. Very well. Are there any other questions? If not, then I'm told, Chairman Considine, that we need to modify your motion that the bill needs to go to Ways and Means. We refer to Ways and Means. And thank you, Minority Counsel, for pointing that out to us. Any last words as we get ready to vote?
No.
No, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, right. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
All right, very well. Then Representative Considine moves that House File 1375. Do I have the right number because it's late? It is. 1375. House File 1375 be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means. All in favor of that motion, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Thank you, Representatives. And Chair Considine, I began this day by walking in on one of your bills, and I'm ending it walking away from one of your bills. So there's a sign there. I don't know what it means.
I'm offering too many bills. That's what it is.
Members, the file this committee stands adjourned.